show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Tuesday, the 9th evening of February, 2010. I'm Bob, of course. And welcome along to what I think should be a pretty doggone special little evening. Because coming up in about 30 minutes or so, we are going to have a conversation with a legend. And someone that I think will speak to a lot of your hopes, a lot of your aspirations for the country that we hope ourselves to build. Cy Khan is going to be on the program in just a few minutes. I've been looking forward to this conversation for well over 2 weeks. Cy's kind of doing a whirlwind tour in support of the new book and some new music. Because, you see, Cy is not just a writer, not just an organizer, not just a musician, not just a poet. He is all of those things. And he has a new book out called Creative Community Organizing, a guide for rabble-rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. Cy is the founder of Grassroots Leadership. The book includes forewords by Angela Davis and Jim Hightower. Have I piqued your interest yet? I should think perhaps so. Cy says he's going to knock off and retire as he passes his 66th year here on the planet. He says on May Day 2010, which would be May the 1st, 9 days after my 66th birthday, I will retire from my job as executive director of Grassroots Leadership. And when you hear the stories of what Grassroots Leadership has done over the years, I don't know, you may run out and just get active. You may just run out and find yourself a cause in which to participate, something that really, really matters. It may just get all over you. And I hope to goodness that it does. Because the work that Cy Khan has done over the years is utterly stunning. Of course, I should mention to you now, in advance of the conversation, that Creative Community Organizing is an imprint of small print, Barrett Kohler Books. It's also a function of Demos, Ideas and Action. Of course, we've talked about Demos before on this program. It's been a while, but we have. The book itself contains blurbs on the back from Amy Goodman. You know Amy, from Dave Wellstone, the co-chair of Wellstone Action. Dave Wellstone saying, from his earliest days as a community organizer through his time in the U.S. Senate, my dad, Paul Wellstone, never stopped learning from and being inspired by the work and writings of Cy Khan. Amy Goodman saying, democracy is not a gift bestowed by the powerful on the rest of us. If we want democracy now, hey, way to work in the program name there, Amy, that's cool. We have to be willing to fight for it, and we need to know how Cy Khan's passionate new book, based on a lifetime of organizing for justice, offers hope for all of us who will not compromise the dream of democracy. Donna Redwing, executive director of Grassroots Leadership, says Cy Khan has spent a lifetime as a rabble-rouser, an organizer, and a transcendent storyteller. His book is a blueprint for those who really, really want to make a difference. Read it. Have fun. and change the world. And you know what? Anybody going to change the world, it's us. Because the status quo is more than Jim Dandy to the corporatists and the oligarchs and the kleptocrats and the various and sundry right-wing thugs who like working people exactly where they have them, caught in a vice, grabbed by the neck, under the boot, whatever phrase you choose. You don't like being there? Get up, do something about it. PsyCon will show you the ways that over the years he has taken the bull by the horns and met his problems head on. See, I can do it too. I'm teasing. But it's going to be a magnificent conversation. And I tell you what, if you don't mind, I think it might be kind of fun to start off with a little bit of size music. I was kindly provided with an advance copy of the disc Courage, and I've listened to it several times, and it is quite wonderful. So we'll have a little go at it. Let's take track one, and see what you think. PsyCon from Courage.
Down by the river, walking together in the heat of the day. Me on my 2 feet, Otis on his 4 feet, as the geese fly south down the Hudson River Flyway. And the geese look down at the old railway station in his imagination. Otis is flying. It's the existential angst of the Labrador Retriever, and it will last until supper time. In dog years, would I still be here? I can't figure it out. So we turn towards home, where supper is waiting. The river flows on, and the geese fly south. And the geese look down at the old railway station. In his imagination, Otis is flying. It's the existential angst of the Labrador Retriever, and it will last until supper time. It will last until supper time.
Existential crisis. That is that's from PsyCon's disc Courage, and it's wonderful from start to finish. I'm tempted to just sit here and go a little crazy with it, but we will. And I'll get the conversation fired up here in a little bit, along about half past the hour. But one of the things that, and it's one of those little happy accidents that make doing what I do so special. You know, a couple of weeks back, we went to the governor's mansion for a sit-down chat about the future of West Virginia, about mountaintop removal, and sort of making our elected representatives hear the fact that we're not inclined to tolerate it, that it's sickening, and we're going to continue to fight it. Well, the night before that happened, a meeting had taken place about violence in the coal fields. And, of course, one of PsyCon's longtime missions has been to avert that sort of thing. And Cy was present because Cy's been active with another sister organization called Save Our Cumberland Mountains, SOCM. And I've got dear friends in that organization. And he took part in the meeting the night before our meeting. Just to try to get the governor to understand what it was that people opposed to mountaintop removal were facing. Now, by now, most of you have seen the video of Adam Pauly smearing himself with hot dogs and hamburgers and screaming obscenities with his little racist tattoos all over his body. You know what happened to Judy Bonds in June of last year when a mountain removal advocate crossed the line to punch her in the head. For that, the woman, Ruth Taylor, who did it to her, was subjected to all of a $100 fine and court costs. And you know, hey, don't do that anymore. If anybody's watching. Violence is a very real thing with, things like, Save a Miner, Hang a Tree Hugger, the ongoing assaults to which tree sitters were subjected in the last week or so. Just scary stuff. And Cy joined in to try to avert any further violence in the coal fields, and I can't wait to talk to him a little bit about that. In the meantime, there are other topics on the plate for this evening that we can look toward getting to somewhere along the way. And of course, you know how it goes. Your input is everything, the be-all and end-all of this program. We don't reserve any day of the week for you to bring whatever topic is on your mind to the table. I think of that oxymoron, that $40 million gas bag Limbaugh who has open lines Friday. That's the only day of the week when right-wing ditto monkeys can talk about anything they want to. Now, I have no desire to replicate that model here, and if it's on your mind, you are more than welcome to talk about it during these 3 hours that are available to us, evenings Monday through Friday, and I certainly hope you will. Me, you know, talking about violence... It's sad when you see corporate America behaving like you expect corporate America to behave, and that's what it boils down to. Did you catch the fact that Starbucks has knuckled? Yeah, really. Starbucks has knuckled under. At one point, they had said they had promulgated a no guns policy for their various and sundry franchise stores. Mark Morford noted this with his usual particular brilliant wit. And in a column in which he said, it was on February 5th, he introduced it by saying, while Pete's Coffee and Tea respects all individuals' rights under local, state, and federal laws, our policy is not to allow customers carrying firearms in our stores unless they are uniformed or identified law enforcement officers. That via the scavenger. And Mark Morford writes, hello and welcome to our store. Please feel free to look around, make yourself comfortable, enjoy our fine offerings, and oh yes, by the way, please, no murdering. Also, no raping, gangbanging, popping off, stabbing, mauling, stealing stuff, or walking around in a confrontational macho huff, ready at a moment's notice to harass any of our normal patrons with a snarl and a vague threat of violence because you feel it is your God-given right, given how you are a card-carrying member of a pro-gun open-carry sect that likes to strap unloaded handguns to your Wranglers, walk around in public places, and freak people out. Thank you so much! Oh, I'm sorry. I see you're still wearing your little weapon and strutting about like you're the rather doughy, bad-skinned king of the sandcastle. Perhaps we were not clear. Shall we try it again? Clearly, you are not a police officer. Therefore, the management, our employees, and pretty much everyone within a 100-mile radius would very much appreciate it if you would put away that ego-fluffing man toy that is designed solely to kill other living creatures and induce fear and ignorance as it regresses every hesitant advancement in the human soul back to caveman grunting lunkishness. Thank you again! Oh, please don't understand. We're all terribly impressed. It's so very patriotic of you to show off your little popper. Are you in a gang? Are you a drug dealer? Are you going to shoot some scary terrorist, Mr. Pallid, paranoid, constitution, misquoting, video game addicted guy? Protect all of us here in the casual neighborhood coffee shop from those crazy liberals and their health care reform and organic pretzels? Thank you so much. But really, I think we'll be okay without your little display. Enjoy your Frappuccino, won't you? What, no drink? You now wish to order nothing at all and instead plop yourself down in the corner, plug in your laptop, and angrily scour Facebook all day for evidence that your ex-girlfriend, the one who left you 2 years ago at a full what-the-hell-was-I-thinking sprint, is now dating a liberal or a pacifist or an atheist and is far, far happier than she ever was with you? We understand. We appreciate your desire to partake of our new free Wi-Fi, buy nothing, and not give a damn that we can't really stay in business that way. Really, really, we do. What? Look at you. Refusing to step away from the counter and instead choosing to read aloud from your little card that says how it's completely legal to carry an unconcealed, unloaded firearm in a public space. Way to stand up for your rights. God bless America. It turns out you're right. It is legal. Sort of. Then again, so is eating gravel, wearing a giant hat made of cow manure and squirrel tails, and slapping yourself in the face repeatedly while ranting semi-coherently about Jesus, masturbation, and Shania Twain. And you don't see anyone doing that, do you? Except Carl over there. We realize it might seem unfair. Far be it from us here at the Neighborhood Cafe, where families and small children and book readers come to chat and feel slightly better about their day, to ask you to leave because your energy's so low and repellent and so downright silly. But nevertheless, I'm afraid that's exactly what we're going to do. We would appreciate it if you would take your business elsewhere. Right now. No? Very well. We'd hoped it wouldn't come to this. We'd hoped to find a better resolution. However, in response to your insistence on carrying a firearm into our premises, we have no choice but to change our official policy right here, right now, on the spot. Again, we mean no offense, you jingoistic lump of man-crazy. You are indeed well within your rights to be a thoroughly paranoid coward who has no real inner strength, confidence, or social skills, to a degree that you feel you must carry a deadly weapon around to feel like you even exist. We understand your thinking completely. It's basic psychology. Very, very basic. Childish, even. So then, like any business, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone, but we realize there are some people for whom this is not specific or clear enough. We realize some people have to have it, you know, spelled out and publicly displayed. Therefore, we have revised our list. Please note the new sign we have just posted on the front door. We have expanded and clarified a few things. We hope it helps. Effective immediately, on these premises, there will be no murdering, no raping, no pillaging, no gun-slinging, pistol-whipping, sucker-punching. No mauling, jabbing, stabbing, hating, or undermining. No screaming bloody murder. No morons. No panicking. No testing on animals. No jumping for joy. While she appreciates your enthusiasm, our cashier is happily married. Thank you. No live birthing. No dumping. No livestock. No smoking. No smoking the livestock. No exit. No way out. No driving. No spitting. No way. No crusades. No Star Trek reenactments. No skinny dipping in the half and half. No doubt. Thank you so much for understanding. Free sample biscotti on your way out. Morford, Mark Morford is just a dadgum genius. So it comes with no surprise to read Dateline today over at Alternet under the byline of Liliana Segura. So you're at your neighborhood Starbucks, maybe with your kids, and you notice a man sitting at the next table who has a revolver strapped to his waist. Next to him, another man has a pistol. In fact, you realize as you look around, there's a table full of gun-toting customers just a few feet away, sipping coffee and doing nothing to conceal their deadly weapons, aside from steering clear or else getting the hell out of there. What can an unarmed citizen do? Well, if you live in California, you guys listening? If you live in California or a state with similar open carry gun laws, West Virginia would be one of them, as long as it's not in a holster, you can hang a howitzer around your neck and march down Main Street and talk about how you're supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States of America. No, really. The answer is not much. Starbucks, according to numerous media reports, has repeatedly become a popular gathering spot for Second Amendment crusaders. Yeah, because that's what you want. Somebody armed to the teeth, jacked up on a double mocha latte, it's to super shot espresso caffeinated freight train nightmare venti lot whatever. That's what you want. Second Amendment crusaders who have generated a lot of local press in California over the last several weeks for going out en masse, their guns conspicuously at their sides to assert their right to carry. And see, don't tell me for a minute that they don't know where the hell they're going when they go into Starbucks. Bunch of damn liberals hang out there, by God. We'll take Starbucks back for America and get rid of them. Get rid of them toe-sucking liberals. Daggum peaceniks. Where'd the world be if they was just walking around all living in peace? Wait a minute. We'll leave that one alone. We're just a bunch of citizens exercising their Second Amendment rights. A large, dark-clothed man named Gus Constantaris told local news station ABC 7 at a Starbucks in Antioch, California last month. Constantaris argues that when it comes to America's Second Amendment rights, if you don't use them, you probably lose them. Just like the nuclear missiles. Sorry, I added that part. So, you know what? Starbucks originally might have been thought to say, well, you know, no thank you. You know, like the Morford column. But when confronted, the Starbucks... Remember, it was Starbucks who was charging like $9 a bottle for water when water was in scarce and short supply on the 11th day of September 2001 in downtown Manhattan near the site of the disaster. Yeah, Starbucks denies that it has an official policy that embraces firearms. This is the quote, Starbucks does not have a corporate policy regarding customers and weapons. We defer to federal, state, and local laws and regulations regarding this issue. That didn't sit too well with Brady campaign president Paul Helmke. He said it's flat out a cop-out. Here's the problem with that answer, as he wrote over at Huffington Post. Generally speaking, and certainly in California, businesses have the right to bar guns on their premises. It is their property, and just as they can prohibit entry by people with bare feet, they can do the same for people with guns. Think about that! No shirt, no shoes, no service. Now, I always figured that meant that if you went in with shoes and a shirt and no pants, you were okay. But what that really means is, seriously, a store can deny service to, have I got this right? A store can deny service to somebody for not wearing shoes, but can't deny service to somebody for strapping on the peacemaker and I can't talk them coffee words. I just want some damn Java now before I have to get ugly and whoop out the peacemaker. What you want to ask yourself is, Does he want a macchiato? Or a soy latte? Well, does he? Punk? I used to think I'd like to go to California. I think I'm over it. Yeah, the open carry activists say that their mission is all about self-defense. Because you never know when one of them liberal alien gun toters is going to want to show up and draw down. Sweet Jesus. Wish I could whistle better. No, still ain't working. Yeah, closer. Wah, wah, wah. There, I can do that. Where the hell do I live? You know, just, where do I live? Well, obviously not California, but again, if you recall, if you pay attention to the program, and you've been listening for a while, you know that I deal with this kind of stuff here, too. It is nothing to be walking into the store and standing there in the bread aisle and ruminating over whether or not you want the artisanal honey oat multigrain or the classic French baguette, and standing, and suddenly you realize you're standing next to somebody with a gun on his hip, and you think, reach for the bread. Reach for the bread. Y'all saw it. He had focaccia. That's West Virginia. But it's also the starting place for tonight's program. And we're going to, we will have, tons of, stuff to talk about this evening. But coming up, our conversation with, Cy Conn. Can't resist a little bit of this first, though.
Make a new star. Going to California with an aching in my heart.
John Fox parody alert. John Fox parody alert.
Someone told me there's a girl
guy
out there
with a gun on his hip.
Some flowers in her hair.
Yeah, you know what? I think maybe not. But that would be fun. No, I'm gonna take a break here and get Cy Conn on the phone. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. And instead of Led Zeppelin, what we will do is go instead to a little more music from Cy Conn's Courage LP. Do they even say LP anymore? Does anybody even know? But that's what we'll do. Let's try this one on for size. Cy Conn, Only on the Horn.
The man called Tito and Hutto must have been some kind of man, 'cause he sure got a man-sized share of fame. It's not just anybody gets their name put on a building where children are held prisoner in their name. The town of Taylor, Texas, is just an hour from Austin, but when you're there, you're in a world away. Look inside the prison yard, just beyond the chain link fence, you will see young children at their play. You might well stop and ask yourself, what have these young children done to be sentenced to such painful loss and fear. It's all because their mom or dad was caught here without documents, like 12 million others living here. Now you may think all immigrants should go back where they came from, and if they don't, hell, let them rot in jail. But if it was your own daughter in a cell at T-Dawn Huddle, with your grandchild in her arms, how would you feel? What would you say if your old 2, 4, 6, or 8-year-old was growing up in prison like these kids? Since when in these United States do we put kids in prison because of what we say their parents did? Call it family detention. Say we do it for the children. You're lying to yourself down to the roots. But call it playing politics with children's lives and sanity. You're getting somewhat closer to the truth. So if you're down in Austin, take the highway out to Taylor. Bring some good friends with you for the ride. You might even wear a flag pin to show you still believe in the dream for which so many fought and died. Step out onto the highway, turn to face the prison, stare at those walls till you forget your name. Say a prayer for T-Dawn Hutto, say a prayer for all those children, and close your eyes and hang your head in shame.
And, of course, the T-Dawn Hutto correctional, no, not really correctional. It's kind of, I mean, I don't know what you're correcting in when you're just jailing an immigrant family for being an immigrant family, you know. It's great to hear a song like that, knowing the hissy that we had on air about the T-Dawn Hutto institution, and the image of children staring through barbed wire. Why, it's got, well, they were probably shot in color this time through, but there was a time when they could only be shot in black and white. And we know what that time was, and it's just as scary now as what it was then. But enough of me. Sycon is on the line with us. And what more can I say that I didn't say in the lead-up? I'm just tickled pink to be having this conversation. Hey, Cy, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be back in West Virginia. It's one of my favorite places in the whole world, and thank you so much for having me on the air.
Oh, it is an absolute joy, and I want to thank you first and foremost for joining in that that roundtable with the governors of the state of West Virginia about the violence in the coal fields. What was that like?
Well, you know, I don't know, Bob, that I've ever been face to face with a governor before. You know, I thought that he and the first lady of West Virginia were wonderfully gracious, and I was sort of amazed at the hospitality, and then at everyone's willingness to really get down and talk heart to heart about something that's tearing communities apart and tearing people apart. It's a good sign when folks are willing to sit down together and do it peaceably.
And you've been doing that kind of thing all of your life, haven't you?
Well, all of my life so far. I hope it's not all of my life.
Well,
I am determined to make it to 100 years old. After that, I'm all right, but I want to make the even 100. I'm working on it.
And I have
it. Yeah, but the truth is, I've spent, close to 50 years doing civil rights and, labor and community organizing. Some of it up in West Virginia with the United Mine Workers of America, and it's been an amazing life. It's been a good life.
you know, it's got to feel like a well-lived life. And, of course, you're going to continue doing it. I know you're stepping down from your official capacity, but that gives me no sense that you're going to hang it up and start hanging out down at the down at the Legion Hall and just no.
No, I might hang out down at the Union Hall, but no,
right.
I'm retiring from grassroots leadership. This is the organization I've worked with for the last 30 years, but I'm not retiring from the struggle for justice. I'm not retiring from the world of music, and I don't intend to retire from this wonderful dance of life where we sit and we talk with people and we trade stories and we talk trash. And that's part of what I love about being an organizer. You spend your life with people and you hear these unbelievable stories that people went through in their own lives. And then I can take that hat off and put on my songwriter hat and try to do justice to the amazing things that people have told me over the years and kind of help people tell the truth. I think, Bob, that so much of what happens to working people in this and every country is that those voices never get heard. The story is told by the people who've got the power. The story is almost never told by people who do the hard work. And that's part of what I've tried to do as a songwriter, as an organizer. I've tried to lift up the voices of the people who do the hard work, and who make this world work for all of us.
Well, as you look back on it all, did you start out as an organizer, Cy, or were you a musician first, or is there even a demarcation?
There's no line, but it's funny when I look back. When I was a kid, I grew up in Center County, Pennsylvania, on the edge of the hard coal fields, and they used to have cigarette machines, and they all said miners not permitted to operate these machines. Remember that? And I always thought it meant coal miners. Because I figured, that's just dangerous to smoke down in the mines. Now, it was spelled MINORS, and I was, 5 or 6 years old. I just started to read, and I one day I said to, my mom, hey, what do coal miners do if they want to have a cigarette? She said, honey, it's a different word. They're talking about you, not about them. but the truth is, I was raised up with music, and I was raised to be an organizer. I was raised by very religious parents. My dad's a rabbi, my mother was a kind of a homegrown but very fine artist, and they had an Old Testament sense of justice. The Old Testament is pretty clear about that there's good and there's evil, that there's right and there's wrong.
Not the Old Testament sense of take somebody outside the city gates and stone him to death, but more.
That's because they've done wrong.
Right. I'm just playing, but
I am too. But quite seriously, that my folks had a passionate sense of justice, and if they raised me to believe that if you see something being done to someone that is not right, that you go up and stand beside them in every sense of the word. And I think in that sense, I was raised to be an organizer, although I didn't find out until my early 20s that was actually something people did.
And so you completed your formal education and immediately went south. What was your first campaign?
Well, I was involved with the Southern Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. I was in Arkansas, a little town called Forest City, Arkansas, that had been founded by General Nathan Bedford Forrest. He was a Confederate cavalry leader, quite a good one, too. And he was also one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. So, the town had quite a reputation to live up to. And the first campaign that I was involved in had to do with getting African Americans jobs in the department stores in Forest City. They had 4 department stores in the downtown, and none of them had ever had a black face at the cash register. If you had a black face and black hands, you were back there. You might be in the stock room. You might be doing heavy lifting. You might be sweeping the floor, but not working a cash register and waiting on customers, whether they were white or whether they were black. And the first campaign was to say, no, you know what? We shop here. We got a right to work here, too. It's kind of pretty simple, It shouldn't have been earth-shaking, but it was.
Well, it was indeed in so many ways. Sort of going from that starting point to something that's been very much on your radar in recent eras and was referenced through the song from your album, Hutto, why did you decide to get into that struggle? with immigration detention and in particular the T. Don Hutto facility?
Well, I don't know how it is for other folks, Bob, but for me, so much goes back to my family, to my roots. My grandparents were all immigrants to this country, every last one of them. You know, my great aunts, my great uncles, my, you know, mom and dad's folks, every last one of them was an immigrant to this country. And, you know, they were fleeing some pretty serious stuff from Europe. My father's father was drafted into the Tsar's army for 25 years. And, you know, he walked out and walked across Europe. He, you know, cut a deal with the Canadian Pacific Railroad. He was a pick and shovel guy building the Canadian Pacific Railroad. And then he came to this country. And this country took them in. You know, they were not safe back where they were in Europe as Jews, as you know, poor and working people. They were always at risk, and they came to this country because they wanted safety, they wanted security, they wanted to work hard, and they wanted to work at whatever job they could do, and they made a good life. It wasn't always an easy life, and they went through a lot of suffering and a lot of hardship, but it's because they had the courage to come here, and because this country opened its doors to them, that I'm where I am today. You know, who knows where I would be if they had stayed in Europe. I think about that a lot. What would have happened to me and to my children living in Poland and in Russia and in Lithuania? What would have happened to us in World War II and the Holocaust? We would not be here. We would not have survived. So it was the willingness of my country, the United States of America, to say, yes, come on in. Come on in. And so when I see people who are just like my grandparents, who only want to work hard, they want an education for their kids, they don't want some death squad pounding at their door in the middle of the night, they don't want to experience the violence that there is in so many countries, and they come here, and instead of being welcomed as hardworking people and said, hey, come on in, help build this country, work together with us, if instead of that, they're just put behind bars only because they don't have the proper documents that are expected of people crossing the border. And when their children are put behind bars with them, you know, I think of all of my relatives that never made it out of Europe. Where my folks would say, we would sit there looking at the photo albums, and I would say, now who is that? And my mom or my dad would say, well, that's your great-great-grandmother. I'm like, well, where is she now? Look, I'm maybe 7, 8 years old. They say, we don't know. The letters stopped coming in 1942 or something like that. So for me, this is a very emotional issue. I you know, I'm a very proud citizen of the United States of America. I really believe in the promise of democracy and of this country, and I want us to be a place of refuge and a place of welcome to anybody who's in danger. So yeah, when I heard that at the T. Don Hutto Family Detention Center in Taylor, Texas, that you had like 2-year-old and 4-year-old and 8-year-old kids behind bars, you know, with their parents, you know, that was the place I had to be.
And what was the nature of your activism there?
I was the backup. We have, you know, the organization I was telling you about, Grassroots Leadership. I've worked all these years, and you know, there's a lot of stuff, by the way, for folks who want to know more about. There's a lot on our website. It's, you know, grassrootsleadership.org, and you can see a 16-minute film about Hutto. It's called Hutto, America's Family Prison. We had some amazing young organizers down there. Luis Thomas Antibanez, Bob Leibel, a lot of other folks, you know, people in their early 20s who put this whole campaign together. And I was basically, you know, the backstop. If they said, hey, we want to talk something through or we want to get a little advice, I would do that. And for the most part, they really were the ones who put this together. I think that's one of the great things, is that there are so many people out there, particularly younger people today, who know how to do this work.
I went
down there a couple times for strategy sessions. I went down and, you know, the song you just played on the air, I sang it in front of the prison and, you know, got videotaped. But I was very much, you know, on the second string there. But although emotionally, that's where my heart was.
Is it a campaign that is ongoing, or was there some level of resolution? Where does it stand now?
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that we actually won. And this, I'll tell you the story. I'm in Austin right now. You know, I was listening to the songs you played. It says, so if you're down in Austin, take the highway out to Taylor. I'm down in Austin right now, meeting with our Texas staff. And I was down here, came down here, I think it was August 3rd of last year. I came down because we had been working this campaign. We called it the Campaign to End Immigrant Family Detention. And I came down to meet with Lusana and Bob. We spent 2 days behind closed doors. We looked at everything that we'd done over 3 years and kind of analyzed it. What worked? What didn't work? For example, when we asked people around the country to send gifts to these kids at Christmas time, you know, not all the kids were Christians, but it's the time when a few folks expect gifts. And when we stacked them up on a table in front of the prison and asked the guards, couldn't the kids come out for a minute and take their presents for themselves? And they said, no. And finally, after hours, the people in the prison said, okay, we'll bring them in. Did that work? Did that help? How did people react when they heard about it? What was the word we got from inside the prison? We went through every strategy, every tactic for 2 days. And then we looked at the future, said, okay, what are we going to do? Well, we had 75,000 signatures on a petition. We said, okay, on September 23rd, we're taking them to Washington. We will present them to the president if we can. We'll present them to the first lady if we can. We'll do a press conference. We'll say, look, people all over the world want these kids out from behind bars. So we went through all this, and then we summed it up. We said, so what are our chances, you know? And we said, they're not good. They're not good. We said, maybe in 2 or 3 years we can build up enough momentum to get these kids out of prison, but not in the short run. And then the next day, the Homeland Security Department announced they were pulling every last one of them out.
Wow.
So it's a tremendous risk. And they also said, it was just amazing. When I was, you know, I was sitting there, okay, I'll admit it, I was sitting at a bar with Bob and Luisada, and we were just waiting, and this news came in. And I was just sitting there with the tears running down my face because I never thought it was possible. So, yes, yeah, so today every one of those kids and their parents, they're no longer behind bars. And of equal importance, Bob, that the government decided that they were planning to build 3 new immigrant family detention centers, and they decided they wouldn't do it. And if they built them, there'd probably be 1,000 kids behind bars today.
And those were all for-profit operations, right? I mean, those,
they are private for-profit prisons. Now, you know, we live in a democracy, and we live in a country that has a public. It's got public schools. It's got public parks. It's got public functions, you know. The rivers belong to all of us. The airwaves belong to all of us. And you got these prisons. I don't know, Bob, who was sitting around and thought, whoa, what about if we built private prisons and put people behind bars and saw how much money we could make off of them? You know, small business is part of the backbone of this country. But making money off of human suffering, That's a bridge too far. That's a road we can't go down.
It absolutely is, Cy. And, you know, frankly, I take the same approach to healthcare in the United States. The idea that there are corporations out there that are allowed to literally aggrandize and monetize themselves off the suffering, agony, illness, misery, and death of our fellow Americans seems to be the most compelling case, the most compelling argument for universal single-payer coverage. And yet it's something that I don't hear a lot of outside of people like Dennis Kucinich, who echoes the same, who makes the same argument. Do you feel like you've had success over the years breaking through that wall of everything is a suitable, or that there is no, I don't mean to be struggling here, Cy, but.
Well, it's hard to, you know, but Bob, I think if we're all struggling, because it's hard to explain. I think, for example, that, you know, I don't mean any disrespect to anybody. It's a tough thing to figure out. To talk about single payer took me a couple months to figure out what they were talking about. And I'm in this business, right? To say single payer, what the heck does that mean? So, I mean, it wasn't a phrase that people understood. I think, you know, if you're going to name a campaign, you go down to the local grocery store. You go down to the local country store. You go out to the high school football game and you try it out on folks. And if people kind of draw a blank look, you don't use it. It's the same thing with songs.
You've kind of messed up the message at that point, right?
You don't put a song on a CD until you've sung it 100 times until you know whether people understand it. So I think that what people did not understand is that we were simply talking about something really basic that everybody has a right to health care. It's that simple. And we have to figure out how we make sure that no one is denied health care in the land of the free. Now, that's just wrong. You know, it's so ironic because what was it that Sarah Palin called them, death committees?
Death panels, yes.
Death panels, right. So, well, now, first, that was never in the bill. They weren't talking about that. But you know who has had death panels for years? It's the insurance companies that said, sorry, we're not going to pay for that surgery. Sorry, we're not going to pay for that test. Sorry, we won't cover you because of a pre-existing condition. You're just going to have to get whatever you can get. Now, the stories of the hundreds of thousands of people who have suffered and died because the insurance companies just said, sorry, that's not our problem. That's where you've got death panels. But it's a hard thing because, you know, you're up against powerful corporations. You're up against big, big, big money. And, you know, in this society, the ability to spend millions and billions of dollars in advertising, in contributions, campaign contributions to politicians in elections when there aren't even an election going on, to hire every lawyer in town as your lobbyist, you know, that's a city hall that is hard to fight. And I think that's what we saw, is that the insurance companies and the medical industry itself felt that their survival was at stake, and they pulled out all the stops, and the people just lost.
Well, let me, if I may, Cy, turn to the book itself, Creative Community Organizing, because I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that we want them to get a hold of this and study it and learn from it. As I read through it, and let me tell you, it was a joy of a read, Cy.
Oh, thank you.
But as I read through it, I sort of found myself holding it up to myself as a mirror of what I felt like I'm getting right and I'm getting wrong. And as there, you bring up some points in here, in, you know, along the way of telling some amazing stories of your own experience. What you're also doing is offering people a way to go about working in their communities, working on issues. And one of the chapters that just grabbed me right out, I mean, it just because I recognized it, was this idea that if you don't fight, you lose every time.
That's the truth of it.
You can't, we are not in a place, and please feel free to expand upon this, but we're not in a place where we can leave any field abandoned to the other side for their usage. Is that a fair statement?
No, that's a completely fair statement. Look, you know, just to take one example, you know this, Bob, that West Virginia has the highest percentage of its people in the military today than any state. You know that, right?
Absolutely. And every war is the same story.
And every war is the same story. And it's the same story because West Virginia, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a great state, you know? It's got wonderful people. It's got natural beauty. It's got resources. But it doesn't have the education. It doesn't have the jobs. And so, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being patriotic. I admire people who say, yeah, I want to serve my country. I think that's a good thing to feel. I think it's best to make that decision if you actually have a job, right, rather than, well, you know, I can't find any work, so I guess I'll enlist. Those folks are fighting for something, whether it's the right thing, whether it's the wrong thing. And when you go into a battle, you actually don't know whether you're going to win or whether you're going to lose, right? And I think the battle that we're in this country, those of us who are fortunate enough not to be in Iraq, not to be in Afghanistan, we're fighting a battle for the survival of an American way of life that is about decency, that's about sharing, that's about common space, that's about the public. You know, people will say to me sometimes, so Cy, what do you people want anyway, right? And I got an answer. You know what I want? I want my country to live up to the promise of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. We're not doing badly, but we could do a lot better. I want every kid in this country, and every kid in the world, to go to bed at night with a full belly, not to have 40 million kids who go to bed hungry every night. I want everybody to have a roof over their head, a decent roof, you know, like running water in the house, hot water. I want everybody to get a good education and to go as far as they want to go. And that includes, like, it's not just a good education. I want people to get good training so that they can get a job that will pay enough so they don't need to worry about health. And so that they, if their kids want to go on to college or on to trade school, that there's the money to do that. I want everybody to have health care. I don't want, you know, my kinfolk or yours or anybody else to have to worry that if they get sick, they might die because they
right and to have care. a chance to pursue their dream. This is a country that we need plumbers as well as philosophers.
Well, you know, I'm married to a philosopher and I'm a fairly good plumber.
See?
Yeah, and you know, I'm absolutely, because you know, I mean, I was talking to I don't know if you know Susan DeMarco, but Susan and her partner Jim Hightower have a great new book out. It's about the good things that Americans are doing. It's a wonderful book. And Susan and I, she you know, her dad's a truck driver. We were both talking about, you know, how this country no longer respects working people the way it used to. I mean, it used to be that to be a carpenter, to be a plumber, to be a registered nurse, that got you respect. And people understood that you were given back in a serious way. And now, what do we see on television? High-rolling people throwing our money around. That's I want to get back to where people have got respect for labor and for skill and for craft and for trade and for apprenticeship, because you know what? We could survive in this country without high-flying entrepreneurs, but you get those registered, you get, if we don't have registered nurses, if we don't have electricians, if we don't have truck drivers, if we don't have coal miners and chemical workers, we're not going to have much of a country left.
One of the beautiful things that I've experienced, Cy, out of what we do here with the Horn over the last several years, is that I've gotten to meet brilliant, brilliant people who are those people you're talking about, who are, you know, who work with their hands, who work by the sweat of their brow, who work by the strain of their back, and yet at the top of those backs and back behind those brows, there are just stunning lives of the mind, and you know that's really the mix that we're all looking for, to be able to enjoy what we do, to make a living, and at the same time to be able to comprehend what the world is that we're living in. And
right, no, that's Bob, that's so well said. I mean, I told you, I was talking to you earlier about my father's father, my grandfather, the one who, you know, was a pick and shovel guy on the Canadian Pacific Railroad. Then he was a hod carrier. You know, I bet not one people in 1,000 knows what a hod is anymore. It's a kind of an oak, a yoke, like oxen wear, and it's got a board, you know, like 2x4s hammered together. You put it on your shoulder, and you load it up with 100 pounds of brick, and you walk up 10 flights of stairs to where the bricklayers are laying the courses. You know, it's poor people's work, it's tough work, it's dirty work, and that's what my grandfather did. And I don't believe he ever went to school a day in his life, and he was an educated man. He read the paper every day, he watched the news, he listened to the news, he had opinions about everything, and they were good opinions. And he read everything he could lay his hands on. He was self-taught, but he was educated, and like you said, he had a life of the mind. And you know, if he ever went to school a day in his life, I don't know about that. And I have nothing but respect.
Well, just to give you an idea of the kind of audience that you're interacting with right now, Cy, I just got a note that said, "Oh, I do. I know about hod carriers. I did it."
All right, now we're talking. Were they one? And how did they know about this? See, that's what I love about West Virginia. Is that?
Oh, this is a buddy of ours in Middle Tennessee. So.
Right, now we're talking.
Yeah, and the boss man of this outfit, we jokingly call him Boss Man Wayne. He's a labor activist of many years. Has repeatedly said on this program, it is honorable to do hard work.
Well, you better believe it.
You're so right, Cy, when you note that we're completely out of whack here. We've got more people. And another dear friend of the program is the president of the Beckley campus of Concord University, and he says everybody that I talk to wants to go and be a financial planner. They don't want to learn how to do anything.
Well, right. And you know, Bob, somebody told me the other day that only 5% of financial advisors beat the market. That's not a real good record there.
You know, I can do better in Vegas.
Well, where are we going?
Wall Street is Vegas.
Of course it is.
But they're playing
it's
with
not as regulated.
Well, yeah, and they're playing with somebody else's money, namely ours.
Well, sure. And, you know, I mean, you talk about what's heartbreaking, Bob. You look at all those people who worked at WorldCom and at Enron, whose pensions were scavenged by these people who are already making $50 million a year. You know, I'll tell you a story. Right back when I worked for the Textile Workers Union, there was a fellow up who worked at he was a loom fixer, which is sort of the aristocracy at a textile mill. And his name was Maynard Lovell. He was up in a little place in southwest Virginia, a little place stuck back in the mountains. And this was in 1972, and the Textile Workers Union was organizing the J.P. Stevens Company, which at that time was the second largest textile company in the United States. So we brought about 200 of our union members down to the annual meeting of the corporation in Greenville, South Carolina, right? And we had proxies of people around the, you know, kind of tickets of admission that people around the country had given us. So we had it, and we got in there early and sort of surrounded the mics so that nobody could cut them off, right? And about halfway through the meeting, Maynard got up to the microphone. And the president of the company was up at the microphone on the stage. And he said, "Sir," he said, "I'm Maynard Lovell. I'm a loom fixer in your number two plant in southwest Virginia." He said, "I've done it for 30 years. I'm the best paid worker in the plant." He said, "And to tell you the truth, I'm not dissatisfied with my job." He said, "I've made good money. I've done good work. I've actually been treated fairly well." He said, "So I'm not going to complain about that." He said, "I have got this question that has been bothering me, and sir, you are the only one that I can ask." Now, Bob, what we had done, you know, we union organizers, we had taken the salaries of all the top officers and broken them down into hourly wages, right? Because when you hear somebody makes $8.2 million an hour, that's not real. But when you hear, makes $8.2 million a year, that's not real to you. But when you hear somebody makes $1,762.40 an hour, that's real. So Maynard looked at the president and said, "Sir, I read where you make $1,742.46 every hour that you work." He said, "I'm not even begrudging you that." He said, "Maybe you're really worth it." He said, "But here's the question that's been keeping me awake at night." He said, "Sir, what is it that you do in your hour that is so different from what I do in my hour that makes you worth so much more than me?" And he sat down.
And that's a question almost without an answer.
Well, the president said, "Next question."
Exactly. One of the things that you also bring up in the book, and like I said, I held the book up to myself as a sort of a mirror, and from time to time I feel really bad and sort of ashamed because I'm involved in the fight, the struggle against mountaintop removal in this state. Not nearly to the degree that the real heroes are, the Vernon Haltoms, the Judy Bonses, the Maria Ganos, but I am involved. And I have found myself struggling not to absolutely despise the people who are doing that to us, who are doing that to themselves, who are doing that to their own children, poisoning them, subjecting themselves to just god-awful things that almost foreclose a future here in Appalachia, Si. And like I said, looking back on it from time to time, I'm ashamed. At the same time, I'm so doggone angry at him and want to get through to him. And you say, you're just a tree hugger. You know, I'm not a tree hugger. I'm a guy who loves my children, my wife, and my grandchildren and want there to, you know, I'm eighth or so generation Appalachian, and I want there to be a ninth, which my children are, and a tenth, which my grandchildren are. And if these guys continue what they're doing, not just to me, but to themselves and the rest of us in Appalachia, there won't be. How do you get over that initial urge to just loathe your opponent?
I didn't mean to laugh. I mean, it's hard. But let me tell you something. Back in the 1980s. I was working with the mine workers. I was working in Eastern Kentucky. That's a great union.
No, I know you worked in Harlan, so I know you've seen the hard side of life.
Bloody Harlan County, man. That's all in the book. I mean, Bob, I tell these stories about, you know, and I tried to tell the truth about, you know, these impossible choices you have to make. I had friends up in Clay County, and Ralph was a strip miner. He was a strip miner. Drove a dozer on a strip mine. This is when stripping was just sort of starting out in the mountains. And I was at the house once, and I was sitting at the table with Ralph and Maddie, his wife. And Maddie said, "Si, do you know what Ralph does every morning before he goes to work?" And I said, "No, Maddie, I don't." She said, "He throws up." I just looked at him. He just kind of hung his head. She said, "He hates what he does." She says, "Look, Ralph loves to hunt. Ralph loves to fish. He loves to walk the mountains. And he hates what he's doing to these mountains he loves. And he's got no other work. And we've got kids. And we don't want to go to Cincinnati or Baltimore or Detroit in an uncertain future. You know, we're like you. I mean, it was seventh or eighth generation in these mountains as our, you know, our kinfolks are buried here. Our children are born here. We don't want to leave. But what's his choice?" And that's what I try to think. There's 17,000 folks, more or less, working in mountaintop removal in West Virginia, right? And I will tell you, I believe in my heart that most of them hate what they're doing in the mountains just as much as you do. I really do. I can't imagine that they get up in the morning and say, "Let's destroy a stream. Let's blow all the game off this mountain. Let's make it so deer can't run here, so that rabbits can't run here. Let's poison the wells. Let's destroy graveyards." I don't think they say that to themselves. I think what they say is like, "What else have I got?" Because, you know, mining has always been good work. And you know that a miner on a mountaintop removal job could be making $60,000 to $150,000 a year with a high school education. Where are you going to find that kind of money?
And in fact, you are right in that regard, Si, because when for instance, coal is at a decent per ton price, one man working on a mountaintop removal job can be responsible for as much as $11 million worth of coal per year, and he feels like he's making good money at $60,000. Kind of goes back to that loom fixer, doesn't it?
Well, it does. It does. And I, you know, I believe, and you know, I'll bet you a barbecue plate, I'll bet you anything, that if any one of those 17,000 miners doing mountaintop removal, if you could give them a secure job making the same money, every one of them just about would take it in a heartbeat.
And you know what?
I think the tragedy is they're caught between a rock and a hard place. And I'm with you. I think the only way that West Virginia can survive economically in the long run is to preserve that natural beauty and that clear water. That's the future, you know? And the future is being destroyed. But the people who are making the decisions, those are the ones that are to blame. It's the heads of the coal companies, the boards of directors, the investors, the shareholders, the folks on Wall Street, who, frankly, they don't care about West Virginia, and they don't care about the folks who are doing the work. They're laughing all the way to the bank, and it's always been that way. It's always been the folks from up east and up north that bought the mineral rights, that sold West Virginia families and Kentucky families and Virginia families and Ohio families down the river. They may say, "We care about our employees," but they don't. And what I believe, first, I don't think you ever, you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar, right?
Well, without a doubt.
Right. And actually, I've never understood why anybody would want to catch that many flies in the first place, but completely.
You were about to ask the same question.
Right.
Great minds. Yeah,
but, you know, I believe we have to find a way to stop mountaintop removal. But we also have to find a way that these 17,000 families can stay in West Virginia, can make a decent living. Maybe it's not going to be as much as it is now, but they've got to be able to send their kids to school. A solution that says, "We're just going to throw you all out of work," I don't think that works. And practically speaking, I don't think that we can get the political traction for that. So, I want people to reach out. I think it's hard to see sometimes. But we've we've got to find a way to keep people working, because that's the long-term question that we have to answer.
And this also,
I don't know how to do it. I think maybe not more, partly what I feel is, you know, this, the West Virginia mountains, the West Virginia rivers and creeks, that's a national treasure. It's a national treasure. And here's what.
Oh, I live within sight, or almost live within sight, of a national park, the New River Gorge National River.
Oh man, it's
and yet.
And you know the new river, Bob. You know this. It's the oldest river in the entire Western Hemisphere.
Yes, it is. It is the last vestiges of the Great Tays River, which flowed west to east.
I bet you've canoed it, and I've canoed it, and our kids have canoed it, and you know our family canoes it. We do it down in North Carolina where we live. But
and yet, Cy, because of this steady drumbeat of jobs, mountaintop removal was allowed to take place within a mile as the crow flies of that very river.
That's right. 50 years from now, that coal's going to be gone. And by the way, it's not going to be gone. It's not going to help West Virginia. That coal is increasingly owned by Russia, by India, by China. That's who's taken West Virginia coal out of the mountains. It's not going to create jobs in West Virginia. It's going to be burned for fuel in countries a long way from the Appalachian Mountains. So I think what we have to figure out what I would like to see. I just like the Tennessee Valley Authority stepped in to preserve the Appalachian Mountains, just like we've got the Blue Ridge Highway, just like we've got the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. I believe that we have got to ask the federal government to step in and use federal dollars, which you and I know West Virginia always gets shortchanged on. Let's buy back these mountains. Let's create jobs for the people who are going to be thrown out of work. Let's let them stay where they were born and raised. Let's make sure they got security and health care. I don't think this is a West Virginia problem. I think it's a national problem, and West Virginia's future hangs in the balance.
Well, that's exactly where I've been heading in my thinking. And, Cy, it ties in very well with one of the chapters in your book, namely, don't just be against something, be for it. And what I'm for is a viable, vibrant Appalachia.
Absolutely.
And the argument that I have made time after time after time, and I hope that at some point it gets a little bit of traction in this country, is that green begins in Appalachia. Because as long as Appalachia is left to the tender mercies of the coal companies, then everything green that happens in this country is going to have a tarry stain upon it. Because we're going to have a little ghetto inside this country where we're saying that, it's okay. It's okay to do that to them as long as it's out of sight and out of mind. And so toward that end, I've argued on a number of occasions, sadly, not to the right people, I suppose, that what we desperately need in this area in particular, and I appreciate you being willing to talk about this area in particular.
Oh, listen, it's just close to my heart. I mean, I grew up just up the ridge. Look, where are you right now? You're where are you now? Right?
I'm in Fayette County, West Virginia.
Okay, look, you head northeast up along the ridge. You go about 400 miles. You cross the line into Center County, Pennsylvania. You go about 15 more miles. You make a right turn. You come out in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not today, but where I was raised. So you know, you're not talking about a place that's someplace else for me. It's
right.
Part of who I am.
And toward that end, you mentioned that Appalachia gets the short end of the stick 99.9% of the time. And when we consider what went out to the banksters, those guys playing with playing with house money, on Wall Street. And you think about the fact that we could take every, I just sort of roughed out these numbers, but we could take every single person. And the actual people who are driving D9 cats and dump trucks and stuff like that, and the demolitions experts and so forth, on MTR sites, by the coal company's own estimations, is something less than right at 4,000 human beings. We could take every one of those people, teach them how to put those D9 cats in reverse, get federal stimulus money down here to roughly the tune of, maybe 15 billion tops. And every one of those individuals would have a job for the rest of his life.
Absolutely.
Putting things back to rights The coal cut, we could end mountaintop removal, have complete employment of every former mountaintop removal worker, and then start working on the viable, sustainable, renewable economy for which Appalachia has yearned for these centuries. You know,
well, and as Yerman has always, I mean, Appalachia was a self-sufficient society. You know, the rest of the country forgot we were there.
I'm fond of saying that Appalachia was sustainable before sustainable was cool.
Well, before it got discovered.
Yeah.
But you know, because what mountaintop removal destroys is not just the mountains. It is destroying what it means to be a mountaineer. It's destroying a way of life. I listen. You know, you call that some heroic people. You know, and Vernon and Judy and Maria, but they just represent hundreds and thousands of people. You know, I mean, what does it mean to tear up a family graveyard and push it down the side of a mountain? What does it mean to dynamite somebody's home where they have lived for, like, you, eight generations, dynamite it off of its foundation? What does it mean to have sludge ponds, dams that endanger schools that could go down and could, like, could God forbid have another Buffalo Creek flood? What does it mean that people have to leave home because everything around them has been destroyed? West Virginia has been struggling to keep its people for, you know, every census, if barely hanging on, barely hanging even. It's destroying a way of life that is a way of life that means something that the rest of the country could learn a lot from. So it's not just that we have to stop mountaintop removal. We have to stop graveyard removal. We have to stop creek removal. We have to start people removal. We have to stop school removal. All these proceed from this terrible practice of blowing off the tops of mountains, and it's a battle. Sure, of course, we need to preserve the beauty and the natural resources of West Virginia, but we have got to preserve the people of West Virginia.
Well, exactly, Cy, and you have such vast experience in all of this. Let me ask you one thing, and I've kept you longer than I meant to, and I apologize.
Hey, listen.
But this
can keep me all night.
This has
been. I have to go play music in about an hour.
I wish I was there.
Well, you know, it's Austin. You could probably be here in 2 hours, couldn't you?
Sure, I'll just get on my little light ship and be right there.
Yeah, we've got the Butch Hancock's coming over, the Austin Lounge Lizards.
Oh man!
Yep, you said we're just jamming down here. Where are you, Bob?
Oh, and we've got listeners in Austin that.
All right. Well,
is this?
Hey, well, listen. I can tell them where to come.
Yeah, please do.
Is that all right?
I talked
about grassroots leaders, the organization that I've worked with for 30 years. That, you know, all this work I'm talking about, West Virginia, that's part of grassroots leadership's work. So we're having a 30th anniversary celebration, and it is a fundraiser. But you know, we respect what people can and can't give. So if you call me on 704-408-1032, again, that's 704-408-1032, I'll tell you where it's happening.
Cool. Excellent.
Yeah.
That's, oh, man. I'd love, and the, Austin, the Austin
stuff,
Lounge Lizards, they're legendary.
Oh, man. I was Tom Pittman, he's the tall guy that plays the steel.
Yeah.
Tom and I have been playing, we were playing music 45 years ago. In an old sawmill shack I had in North Georgia, in Fannin County, and he'd come by, him and a fellow named Mike Williams, and we would play Cuckold Hen and Crow Black Chicken and Waterbound, you know, all those good old tunes. So we're playing again tonight. It's 45 years.
Pure magic. Well, you will need to limber up a little bit, but let me just ask you this question.
Limbering up's a little bit tougher at 65 than it was at 21.
I'm not the guy who said that.
I said it. I'm just talking about me. There may be liberal folks out there, but I'm not one of them.
But seriously, you have a lot of experience inside so many quests for justice inside this country. And when I talk about mountaintop removal, I have urged strenuously that while yes, it's an environmental movement, that we will achieve even greater success than we have seen thus far. When we begin to convey to people that this is a human rights movement,
it is, and the human rights include those union and non-union miners who need to wise up and join the union, but it include, I shouldn't have said that, but you know, because I've been a trade unionist all my life. I'm a very proud member of the American Federation of Musicians. I'm on the organizing committee for my local, and when people say, so what do we need in this country? It's like, a really good, strong, progressive labor movement like we used to have. And you know that West Virginia always has been the state with the highest percentage of union members in the entire country.
Yes.
Always led the country.
Well, my grandfather and my great-grandfather both were involved in the movement to actually bring in the United Mine Workers of America at a time when it was a casually applied capital offense to
yeah,
do so.
Say that again.
With all of that in mind, is there, as you have observed the struggle here in all of this, Cy, is there anything particular that strikes you as being done right versus being done wrong?
You know, that is a really good question. I did not mean in any way to suggest that anybody's doing anything wrong. I think it's very
no. I'm asking that because this isn't just an interview. This isn't just radio. We call what we do here activist radio. And I've got an opportunity to learn at the feet of a master, and I want to. So I'm asking that for my own benefit as much as anything else.
Hey, you know, there's a British folk rock band called the Oyster Band, and they've got a song that says, "I took up the fiddle and I put down the gun." Right? I believe everybody in West Virginia needs to put down their guns and pick up the fiddle. And I'm talking to the working miners who are doing mountaintop removal. I'm talking to the environmentalists. If folks don't sit down together and figure out a solution that works for everybody, there's not going to be a solution that works for anybody. And I think it's got to be a solution that says what's good for West Virginia and West Virginians, not what's good for absentee-owned coal corporations, even if they've got a president who's from West Virginia who's fronting for you know, multinational corporations that never have had and never will have West Virginia's self-interest at heart. And I believe people have got to come to the table and say, we have a real problem. And the environmentalists didn't cause it. I don't like this term, environmentalist. That's, you know, that was just thrown at people to make them seem like outsiders. The West Virginians who are tired of seeing the state in which they were born and raised destroyed. That doesn't make you an environmentalist. That makes you a patriot. And
that's the way I see it.
Who are afraid that they're going to lose everything they have. Somewhere there is a solution to this that preserves West Virginia, that gives the people who dig the coal jobs and security, and let's move on together. But I think that the threat of violence or the willingness to use violence is a terrible mistake, an absolutely terrible mistake, because the worst thing that can happen, frankly, to the if one of the activists gets hurt, it's going to hurt the coal corporations, and they need to know that, and they need to say, to the folks working for them, there's you know, you threaten somebody, you know, you pack a gun, you shoot into somebody's house, you deliberately set up a dynamite charge, you know it's going to damage your property, you've lost your job. Right then and there, they need to say that. They need to say there is no place for this. And I think everybody who's in power needs to say to everyone, all right, that's it. No more violence, no more threats of violence. Like it or not, we're in this together. Because, you know, Bob, when the coal is gone, and the coal will be gone, folks are going to have to live together as neighbors. And you and I know how long those blood feuds run.
Yes.
Right? You know how those run for generations, and they tear communities and families apart. That was a rough part of history in West Virginia throughout the mountains. All the Hatfields and the McCoys and the Allen family feuds. A lot of people died in those. A lot of people got hurt. In the year 2010, that is not how we can settle this. There's no violent settlement here that works for anybody. So, you know, my advice is, you put down the gun, pick up the fiddle, remember where you came from, and let's sit down and let's say, okay, we have a real problem, we have rights in conflict, we have feelings in conflict, but we are all here, we are all mountaineers, and we're going to decide without the outsiders who do not have our history, our graveyards, our schools, our mountains, our creeks, our colleges, our jobs. We can't be sacrificed on that altar.
Well, I've got chills on the back of my neck, Cy. I really do. That's a way forward. And, you know, it's interesting because, like I said, I was at that meeting that took place the day after the meeting that you were at. And Joe Manchin did come out. The governor of the state did come out. And you know what a genial man he is. He came out after that meeting and he said, you know, I want to reiterate that violence will not be tolerated in this ongoing discussion, this ongoing dispute, this ongoing disagreement. Violence will not be tolerated. And he made that very, very plain, Cy. But what did not follow from that, and I think it's telling, what did not follow from that was any statement by any important personage inside the coal industry saying, we hear you, Governor Manchin, and we are taking you at your word, and there will not be.
Well, you know, if I'm reading Governor Manchin right, they will sooner or later. And I don't know if the governor is listening, but if he is, I just want to say, for that statement, thank you.
It was a right first step. It was indeed, and I hope they took it seriously because seeing a dear friend like Judy Bonds punched in the head,
mm-hmm.
Seeing the footage of Adam Pauly screaming obscenities at Larry Gibson's, you know, another one of those heroes, at Larry Gibson's July 4th picnic, and screaming about slitting people's throats in the middle of the night. And the ongoing postering and message board posting of save a miner, kill a tree hugger, what those brave souls in the trees were subjected to in freezing cold, levels of noise from air horns that exceeded anything that either OSHA or MSHA would recognize as being safe, threats of spraying them, coal company threats of spraying them with freezing water in the dead of winter and causing them to fall 60 feet out of a tree. It is sobering, Cy.
Yeah. Well, and your heart has to go out to those folks. But I've never sat down with a governor before in my life. I'm an organizer. I don't ordinarily speak to people in power. I work with the little people. Now, they're not little people in any real sense, but I work with the working people. I work with the poor people because I believe that they can speak for themselves more eloquently than I can ever speak for them. But, and like I said earlier, I would not want myself to be on the wrong side of Governor Manchin. I think when he says something, he says it because he's serious about it, because he's considered it, and I believe that anybody who feels like, oh, well, we'll just, we don't need to worry about what the governor said. We'll just keep doing business as usual. I think that's going to prove to be a fairly grave misjudgment.
And finally, before we do wrap up, Cy, let me ask you this. What does it mean, and I direct this to everyone listening to the program as well as myself, what does it mean when you say pull your shift?
Have I got a couple minutes?
You do.
Yeah. You know, I told you earlier, Bob, that I worked for years as an organizer in the textile industry for the Textile Workers Union of America. So many people that I run into, people of good heart, people, you know, with, like we were talking earlier, people who may not have had formal education, but people who had, you know, wisdom, who had understanding, so many people are just discouraged. They're just plain discouraged, and they'll say to you, they'll say to me, I bet you get these calls all the time on the show, you know, when's it ever going to change? I mean, and people have a right to feel discouraged. They feel like, you know, dang, I can't find a job. I lost my home, you know, and my kids went in the Army because they couldn't find work. And I'm scared they won't come back, or I'm scared that they'll come back so badly wounded they won't even recognize me. These things are real. You don't talk them away. And people say, what can you give me that'll give me hope? And people say to me, look, Cy, you've been doing this for 45, 50 years. Why haven't you give up? And then the first thing, Bob, is something you said earlier on the show, that one of the chapters in my book is, if you don't fight, you lose every time. That's true. And I tell people, you know, we can do our best. We can organize. We can be wise. We can be skillful. We can be courageous. But there's no guarantee that we win. But there's just one guarantee we're given, and that's the guarantee that if we don't fight, we lose every single time. I read history. I'm trained in history. Part of my I've lost track of how many songs I've written, but in the songs that I've written, I've tried to write the history of working people in Appalachia in the South, of the miners, of the mill workers, of the farmers, of the sharecroppers, the tenant farmers, as they told it to me. These are ways of life that are going out of West Virginia. 40 years from now, there might be a couple of dog hole mines in West Virginia, but that's all there's going to be. Coal is the past, it's not the future. And as I read history, people say things are worse today than they ever were. It's not true. It is not true. There are some things that are worse, but lives for working people, for poor people, for LGBTQ people, for women, for older people, fundamentally better. Got a long way to go, but fundamentally better. And if we expect that everything will change in our lifetimes, we're just headed for disappointment. But I never thought that the world would be perfected in my life. And what I'm trying to do is pull my shift. And I learned this from organizing in the textile industry, because you know how it works. The textile mills run 24 hours a day, 51 weeks out of the year. That's when we still had mills in the United States of America, where we had a million mill workers spread out from West Virginia down to Alabama.
Right.
Today there's maybe 10 or 15,000 left, you know. And they ran three shifts every day. So what would happen? Let's say you were a weaver working in the weave room. You know, and let's say that, you know, let's say you're working hoot owl graveyards. If you know folks in West Virginia, I don't need to explain what hoot owl and graveyard are. So about 11:30 at night, you know, you head down to the mill. Maybe you stopped off. Maybe you had a beer. Maybe you had a Coke. Maybe you went and bowled a couple and whatever. But you go down and there's 100 other folks like you, and they're just standing in front of the mill under the arc lights and the, all that dust, the smell of the cotton dust in the air and the glow off the cotton, you know, all those little tiny little pieces of cotton kind of illuminating like fireflies or small stars. And then as you approach midnight, everybody starts to go into the mill. You kind of line up and you go in through the different doors. You go past the clock and you punch in. And then you go to your job. Now, in a textile mill, the workers don't make cloth. The workers tend the machines that make the cloth. Because when you've got a shuttle going back and forth at 100 miles an hour, it's going to break out. It's going to tear up the threads, and you've got to tie them back together and get that machine back to work. So you go, let's say maybe you've got 22 looms you're tending that night. Well, when you walk in there, there's somebody else tending that set of looms. And you walk up to them and you say, "Hey, how's the job running tonight?" And sometimes they say, "You know what? It's running smooth as glass. You're going to have a good time with it tonight. Hadn't had a breakout all night. Hadn't had to call the loom fixer one time." And sometimes they'll say, "Whoa, it's running rough. It's a mess. You're going to have a time of it tonight. I've done my best, but I'm not leaving you a very good job to run." But whether the job is running rough, Bob, or whether the job is running smooth, when that whistle blows at midnight, the weaver on the second shift, on swing shift, takes a step backwards. You take a step forward to where they've been standing, and you start to tend those looms. And for 8 hours, you do your best. And if something breaks down, you do your best to fix it, or you call the loom fixer over. And at 8 in the morning, about a quarter 8 in the morning, you look back, and there's the first shift weaver standing beside you, and they say, "How's the job running?" And if you're a good worker, and if you care about the other workers in the mill with you, if you care about your kinfolk and the members of your neighborhood and your community, then what you do in your 8 hours is you run the job as well as you can, and you try to make it run just a little bit smoother for whoever comes after you, because that mill is never going to stop running. And that's what it means to work for justice. It's not our responsibility to finish the job, and we know that we can't. You know, the damage that's been done to the world is just that we inherited. It'll take hundreds of years to fix. But if we can pull our shift, And during our time of work on Earth, if we can do what we can and make that job run just a little bit better, you know, then when you come to the end of our days, we can do it with absolute confidence that there will be other hands ready to step in and carry on the work. You and I, Bob, did not invent the struggle for justice. We inherited this over 1,000 years of people trying to make this world a better place. But we can do our work in absolute confidence that other people will come after us and pick up the work from us. So I say, you know, I end my book. It's called Creative Community Organizing, A Guide for Rabble Rousers and Activists and Quiet Laborers for Justice. And I say, if we truly want justice someday, all we have to do is to pull our shift.
Don't have to solve it all. Just do what you can do.
That's all that's asked of us.
Exactly. Cy Conn, thank you so much. It has been a privilege and an honor.
It's an honor to be on your show and you know, to spend an hour back in West Virginia. And I hope all my friends there got a chance to listen. And, you know, I'm thinking of y'all.
Thank you very much. And I look, you know, someday I hope to meet you, Cy. And
that'd be great.
I think it would be wonderful. Right. And if you make all it back this way, I want to know. You take care, Cy. Bye now. Legendary organizer, activist, musician, poet, artist, Cy Conn, author of the brand new book, Creative Community Organizing, A Guide for Rabble Rousers, Activists, and Quiet Lovers of Justice. Cy is the founder of Grassroots Leadership. You can go to the website at grassrootsleadership.org and get the book. This is a wonderful book. It really has. It's been a joy to read. It is a combination of history, of uplift, and of simple nuts and bolts how-to. And frankly, if you ask me, we need that. We need all of that and more right now. The other side, they got all the money in the world. All we have is a willingness to see justice done and the heart and the brains to drive toward it on our shift. This is my shift, these 3 hours a night. And what a joy you make that shift, all of you. Tell you what, we're going to fire up another tune from Cy's upcoming album, Courage. This seems more than appropriate. Molly Maguire, Only on the Horn.
Out in the darkness, down at the breaker, close on the midnight hour. Steadily working, quietly leaving, trailing a thin line of powder. The little Schuylkill Valley tan is all lit up tonight by flames that lick like tongues from the breaker fire. The tight-lipped coal and iron police won't get much sleep tonight, looking for the sons of Molly Maguire. Together, strong men are hiding their sorrow. Over at Pottstown, they're at the prison. 10 men are hanging tomorrow. I only tried to organize the men I worked among, but I'm hanging in the barn. Will you miss me? And Monday early so they say, the mines will open back. The coal and iron police are drinking whiskey. Out in the darkness, standing together, 10 men are lined on the gallows, holding a red rose, waiting for sunrise. King of the Mollies, Jack Kehoe. The Trappist Frunk and Molly's sons are traveling into time, murdered by the man who hoped to hang her. But the unborn souls of Union men are all with her tonight, and the Pennsylvania pits are dark with anger.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, February 9th, my father's birthday, 2010.
Snowpocalypse in Washington, but not in Vancouver. Toyota recalls, the Green Police, plus...
We need an all-of-the-above approach to energy policy.
Sarah Palin speaks Tea Party.
That means proven conventional resource development and support for nuclear power.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Everything is made out of corn now because the corn lobby is very powerful. They have a lot of money, and the first primary is in Iowa. Trust me, if the first primary was in Vermont, we would be putting maple syrup in our cars.
Bingo, Bill Maher. This is your Green News Report. Today's Green News Report is brought to you by Velvet Revolution's Stop the Chamber campaign. Concerned about the Supreme Court's recent ruling allowing unlimited corporate cash in American elections? So is VR. It's time for we, the people, to fight back against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and their corporate cash laundering operation. Please sign on and donate to StopTheChamber.com to help the citizens take on the corporatists. It's your democracy. Use it or lose it. Visit StopTheChamber.com today. Okay, Desi Doyen, well, I hope all you greeny green guys are proud of yourselves. The Prius has now been recalled, millions of them. Doesn't that just prove that you and your greeny green friends' technology doesn't actually work?
Well, actually, no. The huge Toyota recall has expanded to only some of the car company's Prius models. Those other models, the millions, are actually for conventional gasoline-powered cars. Toyota announced it's recalling just over 400,000 Priuses for problems with the braking system. It applies only to the third-generation Priuses built after May 2009. First- and second-generation Prius vehicles have a different braking system. Owners of cars included in the recall will be contacted directly by Toyota. You may have heard the nation's capital had a little record-breaking snowstorm over the weekend.
Snowpocalypse.
Yes. But,
Snowmageddon.
But before the storm even hit, the Virginia Republican Party released an internet ad attacking two Virginia House Democrats, Rick Boucher and Tom Perriello, for voting for climate legislation. The ad shows photos of snow telling voters to call Boucher and Perriello and tell them how much global warming they got this weekend.
So the notion here being that because there was snow in Washington, D.C., there is no global warming around the globe. Is that right?
That seems to be what they're trying to say. So let's review. Weather is not climate. Weather is short-term local conditions, while climate is long-term global trends. Climate scientists say that while no individual event can be directly tied to global warming, they do predict a trend in the climate towards more unpredictability and more record-breaking extreme and intense weather events.
And this trend, of course, has gone on around the globe over the last decade, which was, as we have to keep repeating, the warmest in recorded history. Press on.
Speaking of unpredictability and record-breaking, organizers for the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, British Columbia, would probably like some of that East Coast snow. Vancouver just had the warmest January on record, and the lack of snow at one of the outdoor venues is complicating plans for some events. Opening ceremonies are on Friday, so Olympic officials are trucking in snow from other regions rather than change venues. The president of the International Olympic Committee said in an interview today that the IOC will have to consider global warming as a factor in selecting future cities.
Wow. So not enough snow for the Winter Olympics.
Only for one mountain, one of the other mountains has enough snow.
Gotcha.
On Sunday morning, an explosion at a natural gas plant killed 5 people and injured 12 in Middletown, Connecticut. The plant, owned by the Clean Energy Corporation, that's clean with a K, cost over $1 billion to build and was near completion. When it was set to open this summer, it was to have been one of the largest power plants in New England. The cause of the accident is under investigation and will likely mean increased scrutiny for natural gas power plants, which have half the emissions pollution of coal-fired power plants. More than 100 million people reportedly tuned into the Super Bowl on Sunday, arguably as much for the commercials as for the game itself. Last year's slate of ads included lots of companies touting their sustainability and energy efficiency, but this year, not so much. Just one from Audi.
Okay, paper plastic.
Plastic. That's the magic word. What? Green police. Ah. You picked the wrong day to mess with the ecosystem, plastic boy.
The ad portrays police arresting hapless men for minor environmental infractions, except for the guy who has Audi's new diesel car.
I thought it was hysterical. Hilarious. As a matter of fact, we'll put the entire video up on our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Finally, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin spoke at the National Tea Party Convention in Nashville over the weekend, and in her 40-minute speech spent a good minute and a half on energy.
We need an all-of-the-above approach to energy policy.
Again, the all-of-the-above approach is limited to conventional sources like oil and gas, and she made no mention of renewables or clean energy.
I think Stephen Colbert best summed up her speech when last month Colbert said,
their energy plan calls for alternative fuels like oil from shale and oil from tar sands, and solar cells that convert clean sunlight into oil.
I think that's about right, isn't it? For more on all of that and the stuff we didn't get to today, check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Follow us on Twitter. Download us on iTunes. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Nuclear Green News Report.
Are you ready for the great?
The long night falls on cannonballs that stack upon the White House lawn, like sentries posted just before the battle. The air is harsh with sounds of guns, the country torn, the death of sons. The cannons roar, the sabers angry rattle. A quiet man, a lonely man, Abe Lincoln walks tonight. Affairs of state, the wheel of fate, the devil's dance of luck and chance, I picked you out to lead where man will follow. And while you deal with complex things, alliances and deals with kings, the bodies mount at Gettysburg and Shallow. A thoughtful man, a troubled man, Abe Lincoln walks tonight. And if you could come back again and see the mean and selfish men who deal in lies and compromise the nation, you consider all the pain, the battles fought, the loss and gain, still worth it for the Union's preservation. A tired man, a lonesome man, Abe Lincoln walks tonight. A tired man, a lonesome man, Abe Lincoln walks tonight.
Cy Conn from the album, upcoming album, Courage. And we are more than halfway through the program for this evening. It is about 10 minutes before 8 p.m. here in the Eastern Time Zone, here on the East Coast, here in wild, wonderful, almost level West Virginia. I'm Bob. Welcome to any new listeners that are out there. I know you find us every day. This is perhaps the most interactive program that you will ever, ever, ever find. And do not hesitate to get involved. Do not hesitate to get involved with the program. Our interaction is what it is absolutely all about. It's real easy to reach the program, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, and then if you like to spell on your keypad, H-E-A-D-O-N. You can reach us direct dial if you've got some sort of unlimited long-distance dialing plan. At 304-658-3333. Anyway is fine by me. Email rolls in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. Like I said, there is a ton of stuff to get after this evening, and we will try to do as much of it as possible over the course of the program. I'm still just a little bit blown away by the conversation with Cy. And just to let, I mean, I've said this a million times, but this is not my shtick. What I do behind this microphone is not an act. You know, any time that Flush Flembald gets caught out doing something repulsive, he'll say, "Well, my friends, I'm only an entertainer here." Nope. I hope you're entertained by the program, but entertainment is not the goal. It is the creation of discussion and dialogue. It is, sure, having a lot of fun, carrying on a little bit. Over at Open Left today, I was made aware of a column by David Sirota, in which he addressed, he also picked up, and, you know, he does radio well as now as well as his print stuff. He's on, I guess, Denver's AM 760. And he's having a go at the radio gig. I've never heard him. I presume, given the smarts with which he writes, that he also does radio pretty well, too. But he picked up that Danny Goldberg piece that we discussed last week. And in the course of doing so, mentioned something I thought was very important. You can find the piece over at openleft.org, openleft.org. And talked about the fact that we have yet to fully understand, and I know a lot of folks, not you guys, but I know a lot of folks who don't understand that liberal radio has to be more than simply going hammer and tongs at some issue 24/7 or three hours a night or whatever it is, and that one-trick ponies won't cut it. I know people out there, not going to mention them by names, and I'm not offering this by way of a criticism, but I know people out there that are trying to do labor programs. that are nothing but stories about labor, many of which can get drier than a snake's belly in a wagon rut. It doesn't work. I talk about mountaintop removal a lot here because I happen to live near it and it happens to impact my life, but I know darn good and well that if I tried to make every show out of it, I'd dry up in a hurry. So with all of that, and the same applies to any particular issue within the liberal spectrum. We've got to have the ability to talk about more. Well, and to talk about some fun stuff. You know, my particular hang up is watching Tony Bourdain on Monday nights on the Travel Channel. May not be yours, but it's mine. And we have our delightful little impromptu food porn segments. And that's a big hoot. And it breaks up the horror. There's a lot of hell and damnation out there that would leave not just you but me ready to crawl into a corner and huddle up in a little fetal ball and weep if we didn't find some way to laugh. You know, thank God for Sarah Palin. The palm reader, you know. Thank God for any number of things. Because the horrors are real. Thank God for Mark Morford. What a great way to get started this evening. And you know, PsyCon's success has been a mixture not just of outrage over the way that working people are treated, or outrage over the injustice of toddlers behind barbed wire fences. It's also the happy combination of music and poetry and, yes, dance and visual art, writing, all of that comes together to form what we hope would be the whole of a progressive, or in the word I prefer, liberal approach to broadcasting. So if you want to, go over and go over to openleft.org, read David Sirota's take. It's pretty smart. I chimed in at some point and left a link to the Buzzflash profile just by way of showing folks how excited people can get, as you guys did, and I'm still so moved by what you put there at Buzzflash on the Horn article there. Just to show folks that there is a way of getting at radio that speaks to liberal sensibilities that is far and away more likely to garner interest than simple dry bones, one-trick pony advocacy. I mean, I'm an advocate. I'm an advocate for a number of positions. That's practically all. But it's got to have a mix. There has to be a little sauce on the goose and a little sauce on the gander. But for now, let's go to the phones and see what's happening. And jump right in. You know the number, 877-443-2366 or 304-658-3333. Got open lines. Let's fill them up. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, Dave, I didn't get left on hold for an hour today.
Well, hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, I wanted to let you know a good thing happened because of our discussion just yesterday, I believe, that some of the people that listened to your program emailed my Unitarian Fellowship telling them what an excellent program you have and encouraging our Social Action Committee to contribute to it. So
that's wonderful. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. Well, some of your listeners thought maybe they could help. You know, and I suppose there's other fellowships. I don't know what you know about the Unitarians, but they're not religious, but they give enough.
Oh, I know that if I was anywhere near a Unitarian fellowship, my family and I would be there every Sunday morning. I know that much.
Yeah, they're good.
But I just can't. I can't walk into Snake Handlerville, and I'm sorry. No. It's just past my comfort zone, Dave.
No, well, we impose no theology on anybody, and so there's a few that are, you know, actively Jewish or Christian or whatever, but for the most part, we're all humanists. We want to make it a better world, and we feel the job of doing that is on us. It's nothing to do with lighting a candle and putting it under a statue.
Right. Like I've said on a number of occasions, I'll never forget that wonderful trip that I took to tell the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Fairfax, Virginia, about mountaintop removal, and walking out into their parking lot and seeing a car parked out there with that beautiful bumper sticker that said, don't pray in my school, and I promise not to think in your church.
Well, Utah Phillips was one of our best. He recently passed, and I love some of his thoughts on it. But he didn't know what a Unitarian was all about, really. Anyway, I wanted to let you know that you got some people listening, and I would encourage other listeners to get a hold of the fellowships wherever they may be and say there's something worthwhile going on the air. Get behind it if you can. Maybe some will hear it.
I think that would be magnificent, and I think it's a great idea you've got there. And if folks are, we would be happy. Well, let's be honest. From anybody except Blackwater, we would be happy to accept support. You know, maybe Diebold. I don't think we'd cash the Diebold check, Dave.
Well, you know, I think I would.
Well, yeah, there's a philosophical argument for it, isn't there?
Yeah. You do a wonderful thing, Bob. Someday soon I'm going to get on your chat room. I don't know how we're going to work that out. Personally, I believe it is not me that is being seen there because my Patriot Act goons.
No. Sue is absolutely unequivocal.
Okay, because sometimes they go on and pretend they're me and make insults. They haven't been doing that anyway. At least they did that.
No, this is very real. It's a matter of just update your Java. I think that's
I'm trying. They're not letting me do that either, but I'm trying. All right, Defender. Keep up what you do, Mike. Okay?
All right. Thank you, Dave, and thank you for getting the word out to your friends.
Well, I hope others will do the same, because apparently some of the people that listen, they send messages to mine. And we're here. We're the HUUF.org, and some people have said this is a good thing that Dave is supporting. Get behind it if you can. So they called me and let me know that that was happening.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Dave. Thank you very much. And
thank you, Bob.
I wish you a wonderful evening. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. From Northern California, activism. Activism. Good stuff. By the way, I wanted to give you a little bit of news. We've got a new show that is we've got a new show that's going to be premiering on the Horn next weekend, with any luck at all. You may already be familiar with Cynthia Black. If you are not, I think you've got a treat coming. So, by all means, be tuned in next weekend. We'll have more details on Action Point with Cynthia Black. It will be pre-recorded at least at first. But I think you're going to have a real treat as that comes around. All right. Down to business. Strap in. As the punchline to the old joke says, coffee breaks over, back on your heads. First off, from the Don't Do This department, I offer you White House spokesman Robert Gibbs. With this caveat, we had a ton of fun with Sarah Palin last night. We retired her parka. We retired her Neiman Marcus couture suit or whatever. Yeah, she didn't really have a jersey, but we retired Sarah Palin last night as ever being able to compete in Moran Monday again. She is simply the past master. Mistress. Whatever. And we had a blast. And it is more than appropriate because she is a walking cartoon of herself. I don't know if you're prone to reading The Rude Pundit. I am. I just love him. Our buddy Dennis in Kentucky sent me his thoughts on Sarah, and the Rude Pundit did. He wrote of Sarah Palin. Forget about Sarah Palin writing on her hand. Forget about her resigning as governor of Alaska a little over halfway through her first term for no reason other than she was tired of it. Forget that her husband thinks Alaska should be its own country and was essentially co-governor. Forget that she shoots wolves from helicopters for fun. Forget all about all those things as arguments against Sarah Palin when you're dealing with the people who love her. They don't care. All of those things just make her delightfully regular and sympathetically human. See, Sarah Palin is graded on the hot chick curve. Men want to her, and women with low self-esteem want to be her, so whatever she does just affirms that she is hot and able and gets to travel. If she looked like Kay Bailey Hutchison, we wouldn't even be talking about her. Palin knows it, and she, well, you know, review the stocking-clad leg stroking. Palin knows it, and she wields her sexuality like a distraction while she magically steals attention from those smarter than her. And this is a painful paragraph, this one coming up from the Rude Pundit. It ain't just Palin. Let's face it, if Hillary Clinton had looked like Sarah Palin, she'd be president. And if Barack Obama had looked like Dennis Kucinich, he would not. But Jesus, you could argue there was substance there. It's a sad fact of America in the 21st century that shallowness is a quality and depth makes you an out-of-touch elitist. And he goes on, go find the Rude Pundit and read. And so with all of that as sort of prologue, I offer to you this. We had our fun. A lot of people had their fun with Sarah Palin. There's one guy on earth that does not need to be having fun with Sarah Palin. Because it just doesn't end well. Headline, White House, and this is from the Associated Press, White House pokes fun at Sarah Palin. Subhead, top spokesman mocks her for writing talking points on her palm. The Associated Press writing, even the White House's top spokesman is getting in on the act of mocking former Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin for looking to talking points written on her palm during a speech to the teabaggers. They call them Tea Party activists. And you know what? That's fine by me. They can be Tea Party activists because I, by God, have read Lewis Carroll. I know what went on at the Tea Party. It, like this one, was utter madness. You've got the Mad Hatter presiding. It's also attended by the March Hare, the White Rabbit, and is pure lunacy, not a damn bit different from the Tea Party taking place in 2010. Oh, if I wasn't doing this on the fly, I would have already had an excerpt from Lewis Carroll to read. But Tweedledum and Tweedledee were there. You know, it's kind of like having Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh at the table dressed identically. But we've all read Jabberwocky. 'Twas Brillig and the Slithy Toad, did Gyre and Gimble in the Wave, all mimsied with the Borogroves and the Mome Raths outgrabed. Beware the Jabberwock, my son, the jaws that bite, the teeth that, you know. So Robert Gibbs comes out for the press briefing today with the words hope and change written on his left hand. And this is not me just trying to find something to gripe about. This is serious. Don't do this. Just general memo, Oh! Because this is what my, this is my job. This is John Stewart's job. This is David Letterman's job. Not that I'm in a class with any of those guys. I'm not. But this is our job. Having fun with Sarah Palin is our job. Being serious about communicating the White House's intentions and strategies is your job, Mr. Gibbs. Leave cute out of it. When you showed up with hope and change written on your left hand, you immediately entered the realm of kitten kicker. Really? For the Obama administration to even deign to notice the existence of Sarah Palin is beneath them. Oh, God, yeah. Can't you just imagine? Can't you just imagine Beck and Limbaugh as Tweedledum and Tweedledumber, or Tweedledum and Tweedledumass, or, I mean, Tweedledum and Tweedledee in matching yellow T-shirts with Don't Tread on Me written on them? Oh, his vorpal blade went snicker snack. Mr. Gibbs, don't do this. You are the press secretary for a Democratic president. Who do you think you are? Ari Fleischer? Who do you think you are? Scott McClellan? Dana Perineal? You don't get to do this, Mr. Gibbs. You are a Democrat. And somewhere along the way, you're going to get savaged for this. I'm sure that Glenn Beck has nearly peed himself over this already. Don't notice her. Understand that taking her down is the job of the guys and women doing liberal talk radio. Let us do our work. You know, there's an old poem. It was either Sandburg or Robert Frost. I am dirt, let me work. It's out of a poem called Build Soil. Let us do what we're good at. And we'll do it right. You, that just makes you look as, don't, come on, guys, please, focus. But by the same token, there's distressing stuff going on inside the Obama administration. Last night, and, you know, this is not my shtick, this is my life. And so last night when the program was over, I was informed by Agnes that our youngest was having a terrible, terrible stomach ache. You know, fit to make her cry. She'd come home from school that day. And given where the pain was and everything, Agnes was no longer comfortable with just, you know, riding it out. And she said, come on, honey. And so we loaded into the rusty red truck and drove over to the ER to make sure that everything was okay with Doodle's insides. And long story short, everything is, for the most part, okay with Doodle's insides. She was just really, really hurting. And it's something that will resolve and everything's okay. But given my own internal weirdness and the fact that it can be genetic, you don't fool with this kind of stuff. Better to find out sooner than later. But in sitting there for hour after hour after hour, hour, I had the company of what you almost always find in a medical waiting room, a six-month-old magazine. This one in particular was a six-month-old Time magazine, sort of catching up on stuff I forgot I knew. And there was a story in there about the more or less, no, he didn't jump, he was pushed story on Barack Obama's Office of Legal Counsel head. Mr. Craig, and how his exit was orchestrated by a little internal coup that was led by Rahm Emanuel. Mr. Craig had been the point guy for a lot of the stuff that you and I viewed as integral to Barack Obama living up to what we hoped he would be. Rahm Emanuel cut him off at the ankles, as this story made clear. There's a... You would like for things to be running more smoothly than they are. And so, frankly, when Robert Gibbs comes out and makes a funny at the expense of Sarah Palin, doesn't play well. It's not a good idea. On the other hand, you know, leave the funny stuff to us. You take care of the serious stuff, and we'll be the flippant nonchalant types. I saw a photo earlier today from, I think it was called the Houston Press, houstonpress.com. Of a teabagging appearance between Rick Goodhair Perry in Texas and Sarah Palin. And one photograph in particular was too precious for words. It would more appropriately fit in Moran Monday than in Tuesday's show. But still, it was one of those photos that would go in the gallery right next to Get a Brain Moran's. It was that photo of someone holding up a poster at this big rally this past Sunday that said, home, well, I know what it was supposed to say, but it's not what it said. H-O-M-E-S-C-H-O-L-E-R-S, homeschoolers for Perry. And you see something like that, and as soon as you're done snorting or shooting lemonade out your nostrils or whatever your beverage of choice is, you realize, A, what an uphill climb we have, and you realize secondarily that some of these people really aren't that bright. Homeschoolers for Perry. Comedy that you couldn't pay to have written. Comedy that would be laughed out at just, It reminds me, of Pastor Mummert's words that Reverbo reminded us of. The intelligent people are out to get us. Pastor Mummert being a right-wing theologian of some sort in Pennsylvania, quoted in a book by Charles Peirce. Leave the fun stuff to us, Mr. Gibbs, no matter how much you think, ooh, I'd kill in the Poconos. Leave it to us. You do the wonky policy stuff. We'll take it. We're here. God knows, we are persistent, if nothing else. And we refuse to go away as long as there is breath in us to keep us at it. And, you know, we'll do some of the dirty work. You don't need to come out and publicly chastise... My God, it's difficult to look at the photo of this man. You don't need to come out and publicly chastise Nebraska Senator Ben Nelson, Perrin Dino, Perrin, who are you trying to kid, your wolf in sheep's clothing, whatever. Ben Nelson announced yesterday, the 8th of February, that he's going to join the Repiglicans in a cloture vote. And that he will vote against cloture on the nomination of former AFL-CIO and SEIU attorney Craig Becker to the National Labor Relations Board. Now, bear in mind, this isn't just some sinecure. This isn't just some satrapy being given away where the guy's not needed. The National Labor Relations Board cannot function without its full contingent. And... it looks like Ben Nelson is going to filibuster his president's nominee to the NLRB. what is Ben Nelson's rationale for so doing? He said, issued a statement,
Mr. Becker's previous statements strongly indicate that he would take an aggressive personal agenda to the NLRB and that he would pursue a personal agenda there rather than that of the administration. This is of great concern considering that the board's main responsibility is to resolve labor disputes with an even and impartial hand. In addition, the nominee's statements fly in the face of Nebraska's right to work laws, which have been credited in part with our excellent business climate that has attracted employers and many good jobs to Nebraska. Not gonna swear. Not gonna swear. Oh, but I really want to. Because, you see, Ben Nelson didn't sweat a bead when it came to confirming or voting to invoke cloture on walking freak shows like John Porn Mustache Bolton or EPA Administrator Steven Johnson. Nope. The last time a dim leader appointed someone to the NLRB, a guy named Peter Schauber, guy was confirmed without a problem. Sauce for the goose is, I suppose, not sauce for the gander. But this BS. Well, he's going to pursue a personal agenda there.
What does that mean? Everybody's going to have to wear checkered pants like him? No one will be able to... I don't know. What? Is Mr. Becker morally and personally opposed to wearing god-awful rugs that look like dead animals on the top of your head like Ben Nelson does? He's going to try to push a no-to-pay agenda through the National Labor Relations Board? That's... Underwear Friday. I don't know, like the Super Bowl commercial. I don't know.
No, I do know.
Because he has been a lawyer for the AFL-CIO and for the SEIU, Craig Becker, in Ben Nelson's mind, is too inclined to speak up for the rights of working people for Ben Nelson's tastes. Let me just say that Ben Nelson sickens me. We got 59 votes in the Senate. That includes Ben Nelson. Look it. Do a Parker Griffith, Ben. Get out of my party, Ben. Get out! Go! Stand not upon the order of your going, but go at once. Don't let the door hit you where the dear Lord split you, Ben. Get out of my party! We do not need you! You are proving that we do not need you! We don't have to even tell you that. What we do need to tell you is that by your actions, not only have you proven that we don't need you, you've also proven that you don't want us, and far be it from us to sit around like some wallflower at the dance waiting for you to come and... Get out! Go be a Republican! You and your right to work laws. Right to starve! Right to work for less! Right to drive the working class out of the working class to be replaced by people who will work longer hours for less and cannot be organized into a union in the process. You know what's at the bottom of all of this? The Employee Free Choice Act that we have talked about time after time after time on this program. the Employee Free Choice Act that could turn America around on a dime, but would do so by empowering the working class who might be disinclined to vote for a jowly old freak with a dead animal on his head like Ben Nelson. Get out of the party, Ben! Get out! The man was an enabler of George W. Bush, but now he suddenly found a patriotic need to make sure that the president can't be president. George Bush, the white guy, was entitled to freaks like John Bolton, Stephen Johnson, Peter Schauber, but the brown-skinned guy isn't, Ben. God. Craig Becker's nomination to the National Labor Relations Board failed this afternoon by a vote of 52-33. Yeah. Every now and then when I go and I read Bartkop, I see him bemoan something along the lines of, why do I have to be a member of the party of losers? Every now and then I'm reminded of how frustrating it must be every time he feels compelled to write that. Get out, Ben Nelson. Don't sup at our table. Don't drink our beer and wine and water. Don't wipe your nasty mouth on our kitchen linens and act like you're one of us and then turn around and do the bidding of the vile and hateful right wing. I like my enemies up front and not in my back. There's several of these. I expect a nasty little fight if this goes down. Senator Charles Schumer, who, when they're not accusing Barack Obama of having been the most liberal man in the United States Senate, more liberal even than Ted Kennedy, is frequently referred to as the most liberal man in the Senate, Lee. Senator Charles Schumer announced today that he intends to recommend that President Obama nominate to serve as a judge in the Southern District Federal Court of New York, the Southern United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, a man by the name of Daniel Alter. Alter has a pretty impressive resume. He's been an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District. He is deemed an expert in terrorism and security. He also has excellent credentials as National Director of the Civil Rights Division of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. But he's got one more thing. And watch the hate machine just crank up, just gin up. Schumer wrote the following. His outstanding leadership skills, his commitment to justice, and his extensive experience make him an exceptional choice for a position on the federal bench. I'm proud to nominate Daniel Alter. period. Oh, here's the kicker. But I'm equally proud to nominate him because he is a history maker who will be the first openly gay male judge in American history. And that's an important distinction between, because frankly, while we don't know, it's a safe bet that underneath those black robes, we've had more than one closeted gay man sit on the bench. It's just almost statistically impossible not to have. It's like, you know, America's only bachelor president, James Buchanan. These bowling shirts are fabulous. You may expect, I mean, strap in. You may expect an absolute firestorm from the family advocates. If past is prologue. Chat room moderator Lottie sent this along from out in California as evidence thereof. It turns out that the San Francisco Chronicle has revealed what is referred to as an open secret, that the trial judge in the Prop 8 trial in California, a man by the name of Vaughn Walker, is gay. The National Organization of Marriage has proceeded to move into full-on sweat condition alpha mode and is actively having kittens with crocheted tails at this moment. Because it was announced that Judge Walker is gay, the National Organization of Marriage has called him incompetent. They've called him biased. Well, here's what went out to their nasty little email list, these prop hate fiends. Dear friend of Merge. Now, remember, these people are just crawling with money. Tons of money from the Roman Catholic Church, tons of money from the Mormon Church. They've got enough money to burn a whole herd of wet elephants, should they choose to do so. Dear friend of Merge, in a story this Sunday, February 7, I realize it's California, but you still have to read it this way because you've got to reinforce the fact that we're talking here about mouth breathers and knuckle walkers. In a story this Sunday, February 7, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that Prop 8 Judge Vaughn Walker is gay and called his orientation the biggest open secret in the landmark trial over same-sex merch. We have no idea whether the report is true or not. These are probably some more of those homeschoolers for Perry. But we do know one really big important fact about Judge Walker. He's been an amazingly biased and one-sided force throughout this trial, far more akin to an activist than a neutral referee. That's no secret at all. Protect Merge. The defendants in this case are effectively being held hostage by Judge Walker and cannot really comment. But Judge Walker's bias from the bench includes a series of rulings permitting deep and deeply irrelevant fishing expeditions into the private and personal motivations and secret campaign strategies of campaign proponents. Yeah, but see, it's a court trial, and you don't get to have secret stuff in a court trial because there's stuff called discovery. To the best of my knowledge, having studied at once upon a time, though not in quite a long while, the rules of both evidence and civil procedure in this country, there are very few exceptions whereby the other side gets to say, well, you know, and, you know, the one side says, hey, tell us about this. And in discovering, the other side says, nope, it's a secret. Secret campaign strategy. I wonder if they, please disclose any and all secret handshakes, noble lumpkins, grand cyclopses, you know. It wasn't six guys at Protect Marriage that passed Prop 8. It was 7 million Californians. But Judge Walker went so far as to order the Prop 8 campaign to disclose private internal communications about messages that were considered for public use but never actually used. Well, it sounds like what Discovery is sort of meant to uncover. Walker has presided over a show trial designed to generate sympathetic headlines and news coverage for gay marriage supporters. The most egregious and damaging of all of Judge Walker's rulings was his determination to violate federal rules to broadcast his show trial worldwide. The U.S. Supreme Court eventually blocked Walker's efforts and rapped his biased knuckles sharply. I think they enjoyed writing that too much. Ooh, rap me again. Finding that the improperly changed the rules at the 11th hour in violation of federal law. Oh, it goes on and on. It is highly unusual for a higher court to have to intercede in a trial judge's handling of a trial while it is going on. Yet Walker has had that distinction twice in the same case, and we're not even yet at closing arguments. There's only one saving grace to Judge Walker's bias. It's so big and so obvious. You know, can't the homophobic right talk about a gay man without using words like big and obvious? Not only the American public, but the Supreme Court itself is already aware that we have bias in the trial judge presiding, Brian Brown. Faithfully, Brian Brown. So, yeah, look out for the smear for Judge Alter. He is, in a word, doomed. If we can't get a lawyer with a pretty vanilla background onto the National Labor Relations Board, and Harry Reid's not willing to do anything, threaten anybody, nothing, Judge Alter, you know, thanks. I think it was a heroic effort on the part of Charles Schumer. Good for him. Proud of him. But he, unfortunately, Senator Schumer, is member of a party that doesn't like to do confrontations. Or whose leadership doesn't like to do, you know, confrontations. Oh, the nasty is out of the barrel in such a large way. One of the MB girls, you know, there's Michelle Bachmann and Marsha Blackburn, and they're both just loopy as hell, and you can only tell the difference between the two by hair color. Marsha Blackburn is the blonde, and Michelle Bachmann is the brunette. It's as close as nuts. But guess what the new talking point is, boys and girls? Yeah. Privatized Social Security. Because that worked so well for Dim Leader when he was spending that political capital back in January of 2005, remember? She's one of the co-sponsors of the just bizarre, the drug-addled, acid-influenced, wild-ass radical budget proposal that Representative Paul Ryan, Repiglican from Wisconsin, introduced. She showed up on Fox News, Marsha Blackburn did, to say that only by privatizing and putting onto the Wall Street roulette wheel the Social Security program, that's the only way to get some of this under control. No.
42.
Listen to you for yourself.
What that says to us is we need to stop, we need to look at where we are, and we need to address this situation. Certainly the trustees from the Social Security Trust Fund have told us this every year.
Can you transfer this to Medicare? Presumably at some point, the baby boom generation being where it is, presumably at some point, Medicare runs out of money, goes into the red, and that money that's flowing into it, it'll be IOUs all over again.
Well, that's exactly right. And the timeline very much mirrors the timeline for Social Security.
Is it just me, or does she sound a little bit like Carol Kane in the Bill Murray vehicle Scrooged? Just asking.
prosperity. And that is why we talk about these trillions of dollars of unfunded mandate.
Do they teach Republicans going on Fox to talk to the Fox audience like it's Mr. Rogers? Really, she sounds like the host of Romper Room.
That are on our books, and the fact that this is in the outlying years. You know, one of the interesting things that happens is the way the federal government budgets. And when they do their budget every year, they're looking at
I see teabaggers, and I see deathers, and I see birthers, and I see tenthers, and I see all my lovely friends in lunatic conservative land.
5 or a 10-year window. They're not looking at these long-term liabilities.
Yeah.
And it's precisely the reason we need to bring those onto the books in each year.
That means
have an
benefit
assessment.
Cuts.
Oh, my God, are Ripig Licking talking about putting stuff on the books? 8 years! 8 years, brethren and sistren! We had an off-the-books war, or two, or three, but no, Granny's Social Security needs to be on the books.
That means some kind of benefit cuts or tax increase. Now, which political party, which politician will go out there and cut a program which is very popular with voters?
Oh, rubber romper stomperoo!
Well, one of the things that you have to do is start looking at how the program is delivered. You don't necessarily have to have benefit cuts. What you have to do is look at the administration end first and foremost and see what you can do with cutting back the bureaucracy that surrounds that program so that your money stays there. You know, people forget Medicare is a program that individuals have paid into every single year with their Medicare and their Social Security benefits. The federal government has first right of refusal on that paycheck. And this is one of the reasons that we need to make sure that individuals get the money out that they have placed in. This is one of the reasons that we have had the discussion over and over for our younger earners of having accounts that have their Social Security number and their, their information on that, so
right,
that you have that personal account.
It was roundly rejected when President Bush suggested doing just that. Didn't fly. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I've got 10 seconds for you. Go.
I was just going to say, and it's interesting to me, the number of people now that are coming to town hall meetings and are saying, you know what, I bet if you were to scale back some of this bureaucracy and if you were to begin to look at some options for younger workers, we could begin to get some of this under control.
Oh, for God's sakes. Yeah, poor David in Tennessee. Please, Bob, I hear more than enough from Marcia as it is. God almighty. And that's only one. Oh, there's one more horror coming. Saving the worst for last. But to the phones we go. Oh, or not. Okay, so off we go. Yeah, poor David. Look, Blondie, you figure out a way to stop this old boy's check. It's me and you in the biblical retribution sense. But what? Where's our proposal, though? Tom Hartman referenced it, and I had referenced it years or months before. We don't need to be raising the Social Security retirement age. We need to be lowering it. You do that. You eliminate the cap on Social Security's earnings taxation, and you bring the so-called undocumented immigrants into the Social Security fold. You may start solving a lot of problems for both Social Security and Medicare, both. But I guess that's too just entirely complex for your average wingnut to get his head around. And you know what? I have to say, I got to be more careful with what I say on this program. You never know who's listening. You know, last night we had this extended discussion, and I think it was with Gary, about what it would look like if Barack Obama really was a Jedi master playing nine-dimensional chess, and how he would invite the Republicans to a televised forum on health care And they thought, no, there's going to be TV cameras. I can't come. It makes us look, TV's like kryptonite around him. We look like idiots. Wait, we are. And that there had been some rumblings, but no, we're not going to show up for that. No. Lucy done pulled the football away from us once. And they did it on TV. And I said that maybe this is a setup for them to refuse, and then the day after they refuse, say, okay, I invited them to the table. They didn't want to come and talk. I'm asking the Congress to do this by reconciliation tomorrow. I got to be careful what I say on the air here. Yeah, what a monumental moment of Bob's ego that is. But it turns out that Eric Cantor, Britney Spears fan, Eric Cantor, Repig-Lickin' from Virginia, wrote a letter yesterday setting up a bunch of preconditions for how he would show up and his right-wing freakish friends would show up for the healthcare discussion forum, whatever, with President Obama. He wrote it in concert with old pumpkin face, John Boehner. And said that unless President Obama was willing to scrap the current proposals and start from ground zero, square one, that the Repig-Lickins would be, and this is their word, these are their words, reluctant to participate. Well, apparently, I don't know, but Eric Cantor doped it out. He showed up, of course, on Fox, where else, and had a little discussion with Jane Skinner, at which he appeared, I guess they've backtracked, I guess they've found a new position.
If the starting point for this meeting is the job-killing bills the American people have already soundly rejected, Republicans would rightly be reluctant to participate. Congressman Cantor is in Richmond, Virginia, and joins us this morning. Congressman, thanks for your time.
Jenny, good morning.
I take it that letter means it's not an automatic yes that you will show up. We just heard in the last couple of minutes Minority Leader Boehner say that this current health care bill must be scrapped. Is that your condition for this meeting, that there must be a promise to start over?
Well, Jane, first of all, we're going to show up because we want to continue to try and reflect what the American people are asking for. And really, right now, it's up to the President
really?
And Speaker Pelosi to start listening to the American people. If they don't, there's not much to talk about. As the leader suggested,
Eric Cantor, Britney Spears fan, speaks for the American people. Because, of course, you know, Obama, he's one of those people, and he can't possibly speak for, you know, people like Eric Cantor, because he's all pale, white and stuff, right?
American people have resoundingly rejected the Democrats' health care bill. We've got to find...
Really? When? Did I miss that? I try to vote in all the elections. There was a plebiscite, and I missed it, and we soundly rejected the health care proposal. I mean, I know the big pharmaceutical companies rejected it, and I know the big health care companies rejected it, and I know that Repig-Lickins, who are paid to do their bidding, rejected it, but I missed that. I missed no headline, nothing. The American people rejected it? Gee, I've talked to a lot of people on this program, outside this program, that think it would just be lovely to be able to go to the doctor when you're sick.
And a better way.
So you will show up to this meeting regardless of what's on the agenda or how the agenda is formed?
Well, we have stood ready for the past year to work alongside with this president and Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats
Liar.
In Congress.
Liar.
And, you know, now, once again, there is talk of bipartisanship. But what we need to...
Yeah, he's right in that regard. Once again, there's talk of bipartisanship. I'm getting awful damn tired of the talk of bipartisanship. How many times does Barack Obama have to do bipartisanship before he realizes that the other side doesn't do bipartisanship?
Yeah. Really focus on, if we're going to get anything done, is try and address what people are worried about. It's the increased cost of health care. We can accomplish bringing down costs through some of the ideas that we have put on the table.
Name one!
that, in fact, I think that most Democrats agree with as well.
One. Just one. Name it.
But it is first and foremost the fact that this president and Speaker Pelosi are still trying to jam through this bill that the American people don't like.
I guess the tone, I just read a portion of that letter that you sent to Rahm Emanuel, but the tone of it wasn't particularly, I guess, in the spirit of bipartisanship. That's a tough letter. Is that going to affect your starting point?
Well, you know, it is in the interest of the minority in the Congress
Oh, you got to love it. So he says it's in the interest of the minority in Congress, and they immediately show a picture of poor old dead-eyed Rahm Emanuel. Well, not poor old. That's him, the minority in Congress.
Reach out, and we have continued to reach out. But what we want to say is this: we're not interested in.
Yeah, but when you're reaching out, Eric, you're holding a burning cross.
A dog and pony show to trumpet failed bills that, in fact, the Democrats can't even pass right now without any Republican support. We're not interested in that because the American people aren't either. And where we feel we need to go is to tell the president, look, we are ready to work on things that we can agree on. Set aside this notion we need government taking over our health care.
Do you hear this set aside the notion we need government taking over our health care? Well, when you're a person who has no health care at all, government health care looks pretty damn good. And, you know, I'm sorry, Mr. Representative Cantor, Britney Spears fan. You haven't put forward a plan for none, to address the 45,000 people who will die between this time now and this time a year from now. Nothing. You're okay with them dying, Britney.
Set aside this notion that Washington knows best about the kind of choices that families are...
Yeah, because God knows Washington wouldn't know nothing about running no country. Being how it's the nation's capital and everything. No, we need to formulate policy in the ivory towers of Cigna and Aetna and Megadeth. That's who knows health care.
...afforded in health care, and we can start to work together to bring down health care costs.
But again, quickly, you're showing up to this televised thing, right?
Absolutely. Republicans have always said, we stand ready and willing to work with this president on...
Thank you very kindly, attractive blonde lady from Fox. Can't buy this stuff. Yeah. Oh, God. Bipartisanship. Yeah, you know, down home, we say if you change hands, you lose a stroke. Just say it. I speak for the American people, says Eric Cantor. All 27% of them that just love living without no health care. Don't deserve it. From William, with regard to the MB girls, he notes that MB also stands for mothball. These two MB women talk as if they've never had a fully developed brain, either that or part of it was removed, or even some sort of alien abduction experiment was performed. Yeah, well, it probably was. It was probably one of those Ransom of Red Chief moments where the aliens did take Michelle and Marcia away and wound up having to pay us to take them back. About 8 minutes before the program, and like I said, let's save the worst for last. Since Eric Cantor was out there talking about all the solutions that his party has for health care in America, I'd like to know what his solution is for young Kyler Van Nocker. Kyler Van Nocker is 5 years old. Kyler Van Nocker, at 5 years old, has something called neuroblastoma. And neuroblastoma is uglier than it sounds. It is an incredibly rare form of childhood cancer that targets the nervous system and makes tumors just grow all over the body. It is, to say the least, incredibly painful. We as grown-ups don't respond well to pain. we as humans don't respond well to pain. And to anyone who would inflict more pain on a five-year-old, for those religious among us, of whom I am not, it makes you yearn for a few more million degrees Kelvin in that lake of eternal fire reserved for the devil and his angels. Pain unchecked is a window into that hell. Having the pain go away and provide relief to a young lad like Kyler Van Nocker, and then turning around and helping the pain come back? Jesus, that would make the Marquis de Sade blush. In 2007, Kyler Van Nocker's cancer went into remission because of treatment. He had 12 months of pain-free life. The cancer came back in September 2008. He needed treatment again. Health America said, come on, one, two, three, we don't pay. In particular for a form of treatment that doctors said could save his life. It's called MIBG treatment. Health America used that same old nasty dodge they've used to enforce human misery and human suffering for decades now. We don't pay because it's investigational or experimental. They cite that because it has yet to be fully approved by the FDA. They did, however, approve a cheaper experimental treatment for Kyler Van Nocker in April 2008. It, too, unapproved by the FDA, just cheaper. Kyler Van Nocker's parents did the only thing that any of us as parents could do. They went out and they found a lawyer. And they are suing Health America, claiming what appears to be fraud. The procedure is $110,000. That's two rounds of MIBG treatment. My heart breaks for Kyler Van Nocker and his parents. Of course, this is a world that's A-OK with Eric Brittany Cantor and John Pumpkinhead Boner. It's OK with Ben Nelson. It's OK. Yeah, I said Ben Nelson. It's okay with Mitch McConnell. It's okay with Jim DeMint. It's okay with Marsha Blackburn and Michelle Bachmann. And it's happening all over the country. There's a recent comprehensive study that was commissioned by the California Nurses Association. In California alone, the study found that the six largest insurers in California rejected 47.7 million claims in the first half of 2009 alone. That's a nearly 22% rejection rate of all claims submitted. And Kyle Van Nocker, as far as Health America is concerned, simply needs to die. It's as simple as that. And every day, another one of these stories emerges. And every day, that we do not have health care passed by reconciliation is another day more likely that Kyle Van Knocker's parents get to go and pick out one of those little short coffins. Now, anyone who calls himself or herself a human being on Capitol Hill can tolerate that is beyond me. If Kyle Van Knocker passes away, I want Barack Obama at his funeral. Period. And I want Barack Obama to explain to America why he's not used the bully pulpit that he was elected and given so that 5-year-old Kyle Van Knocker could live. It's that simple. And that's the program for this evening. Join us tomorrow night, I hope, for prayer meeting Wednesday. I'm sure we'll have some madness. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for supporting The Horn. The Horn, we're changing things a little bit at a time, but we cannot do it without you. There's no money flowing from any of the deep pocket liberals because they haven't gotten the message yet. The only money coming comes from you, and that's all that keeps the lights on here. If this matters to you, it is necessary that you hit that PayPal button at headonradionetwork.com or use the snail mail address that's there as well under the tab called Contribute. It's that simple. No contributions, no horn. And once the lights go off, they go off for good. Because it's not the kind of thing that you can say, well, if we can just scrounge up another $100, we'll come back on air. We either go and keep going, or we're gone. And you will be the determinant. You will be the determinant. Of whether we do keep going. Thanks to all of you who do contribute to make it keep happening. Thanks to Sue and Lottie in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. To John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Shut up!
No. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Tuesday, the 9th evening of February 2010. I'm Bob, of course. And welcome along to what I think should be a pretty doggone special little evening. Because coming up in about 30 minutes or so, we are going to have a conversation with a legend. And someone that I think will speak to a lot of your hopes, a lot of your aspirations for the country that we hope ourselves to build. Cy Conn is going to be on the program in just a few minutes. I've been looking forward to this conversation for well over 2 weeks. Cy's kind of doing a whirlwind tour in support of a new book and some new music. Because, you see, Cy is not just a writer, not just an organizer, not just a musician, not just a poet. He is all of those things. And he has a new book out called Creative Community Organizing, a guide for rabble-rousers, activists, and quiet lovers of justice. Cy is the founder of Grassroots Leadership. The book includes forewords by Angela Davis and Jim Hightower. Have I piqued your interest yet? I should think perhaps so. Cy says he's going to knock off and retire as he passes his 66th year here on the planet. He says on May Day 2010, which would be May the 1st, 9 days after my 66th birthday, I will retire from my job as executive director of Grassroots Leadership. And when you hear the stories of what Grassroots Leadership has done over the years, I don't know, you may run out and just get active. You may just run out and find yourself a cause in which to participate, something that really, really matters. It may just get all over you. And I hope to goodness that it does. Because the work that Cy Conn has done over the years is utterly stunning. Of course, I should mention to you now, in advance of the conversation, that Creative Community Organizing is an imprint small print, Barrett Kohler Books. It's also a function of Demos, Ideas and Action. Of course, we've talked about Demos before on this program. It's been a while, but we have. The book itself contains blurbs on the back from Amy Goodman. You know Amy, from Dave Wellstone, the co-chair of Wellstone Action. Dave Wellstone saying, from his earliest days as a community organizer through his time in the U.S. Senate, my dad, Paul Wellstone, never stopped learning from and being inspired by the work and writings of Cy Conn. Amy Goodman saying, democracy is not a gift bestowed by the powerful on the rest of us. If we want democracy now, hey, way to work in the program name there, Amy, that's cool. We have to be willing to fight for it, and we need to know how Cy Conn's passionate new book, based on a lifetime of organizing for justice, offers hope for all of us who will not compromise the dream of democracy. Donna Redwing, executive director of Grassroots Leadership, says Cy Conn has spent a lifetime as a rabble-rouser, an organizer, and a transcendent storyteller. His book is a blueprint for those who really, really want to make a difference. Read it. Have fun. and change the world. And you know what? Anybody going to change the world? It's us. Because the status quo is more than Jim Dandy to the corporatists and the oligarchs and the